The football pod with Paddy and Andy.
We wanted to hit Kerry like they were never hit before. And he goes, when we hit them, and then we go, oh, they don't like this. And then they went at them again. That's what Tyrone have to do.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
OTB AM. With Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
Very good morning to you. It's 7:30 and you're welcome along to Thursday mornings Off the Ball. It's Shane here with you, and we're with you right through, as always, until 10 a.m. this morning in all of the usual places. We're live on the OTB Sports app. You'll get us as well on the OTB Sports social media channels. We're on youtube.com/offtheball. We're on facebook.com/offtheball. And we're also live here on Twitter as well, at Off the Ball. And as I mentioned, the OTB Sports app, you can download that for free if you haven't already, in the App Store and indeed in the Play Store as well. Get in touch with us this morning, as always. Leave a comment on one of our apps. Get in touch with us on WhatsApp as well. And just give us abuse, give us thoughts, give us everything as we head into another busy weekend of sport ahead. And I'm delighted to be joined, as always. Not as always. It's actually a rare one. Tommy, I think we did one together, but it's a Shane Hannan, Tommy Rooney special this morning. So good morning to Tommy.
Shane, how you doing? Nice to be back with you.
It's been too long. I think it's been too long. You're a fellow Gael, Tommy, and the reason I wanted to talk to you specifically this morning was because my own local club, Monaghan Harps, had a bit of success at the weekend. Twitter was awash.
I'll be honest. I'm surprised you're still fit to stand and talk after it.
Tell you what, Tommy, these GAA club wins take it out of you in more ways than one. I know Meath Hill, your own club, had quite a bit of success in recent years as well. So the celebrations tend to probably take 5 years off your life expectancy.
It depends on what you're celebrating, Shane. It's a couple of years now since... I know we had a good win with the Bees actually earlier in the summer, the Killer Bees. We won a title, and we won one, I think, a couple of years ago. It depends on what you're celebrating. What were you celebrating at the weekend?
Yeah, I suppose for a bit of context. So Monaghan Harps won a B championship, a senior B championship. So Harps are currently in the senior county championship at senior level in Monaghan. But our B team had a delightful win in the league over Killarney at the weekend. An excellent match took place in Cremartin. 1 point win. Big shout out to Evan Doherty, a good friend of mine who scored 1-2, had an excellent game. So it was just one of those games, Tommy, that defines your weekend, because Sunday evening we knew we'd be having a few beers together, but win and your mood is absolutely fantastic in GAA club level. And you're a bit gutted, I think.
Oh, stop. Yeah, no, I had too many years when your life was defined by what would happen on a football pitch at the weekend. But that's great to hear. Evan Doherty started. How did you get on? Did you get a run? I know you're only got back this year playing football for the first time in a long time. So did you break back in? Are you enjoying it?
Really, really enjoyed it. Now, it was bittersweet of the weekend. I didn't quite get a run at it. I was kind of also recovering from my own little bout of COVID-19. But okay. we had a good run. We beat some big teams along the way, Tommy. We beat Castledinny Fogs. We beat Ballybay in the semi-finals. These are big teams with a lot of GAA culture behind them. So a nice one to win. I think the last time the Harps won that trophy in particular was 2015. So nice to get a bit of silverware. And I'll tell you another thing as well, not to bring the mood down entirely, but... to show how special the GAA was, we had quite a sad time in the Monaghan Harps club of late with the sad passing of Ogie Duffy, Brendan Ogie Duffy, member of the team, and there was a lovely moment, of course, now with COVID restrictions, you can't hold on to the trophy, but we were allowed to take the trophy after the match in Cremartin to Llanlurkin Cemetery in Monaghan, where Ogie's grave is, and. A lovely, lovely little moment and kind of something that I know Brendan, Ogie's father, spoke about on radio last week and has spoken about various times since, how important the GAA community is at times like this. I know Rory Began was on with Jaron Owen this week as well, kind of echoing those sentiments. But to take the trophy to Ogie's grave, to leave it there, you know, where he's buried, and get a few photographs as a team was really, really special. And I know it's a strange thing to think of Ogie being in that graveyard and not out on the pitch with Monaghan Harps anymore. But there's just something kind of nice that brought us all together as a team and kind of to have that moment as a team, especially how difficult the last number of weeks has been. It shows you how important, Tommy, I think the GAA community is, really.
100%, Jim. I saw that photo and it was lovely. And I can only imagine how much it meant, because I kind of started this by saying, messing, saying it depends, the celebrations depend on how much you win, but it doesn't really matter what you win. It's more so, I suppose, the group that you're playing with and being able to go out and have a bit of fun afterwards, I suppose, and look each other in the eye and know that you all did a good job on the day. So, look, fair play on the win at the weekend. And I think you're right. I think it is so much more than that, and it has been over the years. There's obviously a massive game at the weekend, Shane.
Like, we're talking about rivalries. Like, I was trying to compare the Monaghan Harps, Ballybay or Castlebenny rivalry.
I was listening to you. I thought you were making that stretch a little earlier.
Yeah, I was trying to make a nice little segue to Kerry Tyrone. It's not quite the same, but like this game on Saturday afternoon, Tommy, like, I know yourself and Andy and Paddy will have done plenty of chatting about it on the Football Pod this week. But like, do you see this as a rivalry now, or what way do you approach Kerry Tyrone at the moment? It's obviously not what it was in the mid noughties, but it's still a big rivalry. These two teams don't really like each other.
Yeah, there's history there, Shane. Like, it goes back even before that. I think the Plunkett Donaghy back in the 80s. And we're going to actually throw the clip in a minute of Kieran Donaghy and Ricey. We brought the two of them together on Off the Ball back in 2019. And there was a brilliant piece that they did where they spoke about the rivalry. And I was surprised that I hadn't realised that it actually all started back in the 80s. Kieran Donaghy's father, of course, was a Tyrone man. So if one person is well-placed to talk about that rivalry, it was him. And Ricey featured so heavily in all the battles and all those key games. So we'll have a look at them and see what they think about the rivalry in a moment. But I think you're right. I think it is a rivalry, Shane. I think no matter what, you can't get away from what happened between those two counties in the 2000s, like 03, 05, 08. You just can't get away from it. Like, even on Off the Ball during the week, Ger and Owen were having disagreements about who was the better team in that 10-year span. And I think, like, Tyrone just held a special heart, a place in everyone's heart. For, I suppose, what they did against the odds, what they did as a squad, how they dealt with tragedy throughout that time. And they had some incredible, incredible footballers that I kind of was inspired to go back and watch again. Not that I had forgotten them at all, because some of my favourite footballers were Tyrone footballers back in the noughties. But sometimes you just need a reminder to go back and have a look at an old clip or an old video. And we'll play a bit from the Football Pod a little later. And in it, we talk about Owen Mulligan's goal in 05. And I'm sure you can picture it, Shane. Mugsy collecting the ball on the 45. Skin and Stephen O'Shaughnessy beating Paul Casey. Beating the third despairing double defender and burying it by Cluxton. Unbelievable goal. Iconic. But yesterday I watched it back with the benefit of the context of the highlights of the Tyrone Dublin quarterfinal in 05. So I watched about 20 minutes around it. And I suppose when you think about that goal and how big it was, and it's the only clip you really see from that game, the rest of the match doesn't really matter, but it did matter. Tyrone were under serious pressure. This was like a massive opportunity for Dublin that day. And Tyrone were in serious bother. They were 3 points down in the 50th minute. They just brought on Peter Canavan, who was struggling with injury all that year. It was their kind of last throw of the dice to try and get them back into the game. Dublin were flying. Conal Keeney was unbelievable that day. Alan Brogan was flying. Jason Sherlock was in serious form. They had Kieran Whelan and Shane Ryan in midfield. And then Mugsy gets this goal out of nowhere. So they were just unbelievable. So I kind of got to relive a bit of those moments during the week preparing for the podcast. But one of my favourite bits, as I mentioned, that we've done on Off the Ball over the last wee while, was Ricey and Donaghy sitting down together. And here's the two of them talking about, I suppose, who won their rivalry in the noughties.
We had Brian Duher, we had Peter Canavan, and we said, we've enough armoury to take these boys. And we said, the one thing that we thought that Kerry didn't really like was being tackled, so we put a huge emphasis. We said, wherever they move, we're going to tackle them. And he said, we're just going to work and we're going to hound them and tackle. And because we knew Kerry were phenomenal footballers, but we, at the same time, we knew if you give time and space, these boys would kill anybody. So we were determined to make Croke Park as small as possible.
That day, from a Kerry fan, looking at it, as much as Mickey would have liked to see him tackling, as much as you would have talked about tackling, that day you were ravenous out of your mind to make sure that it was going to be Tyrone's day.
We weren't going to, it never occurred we were ever going to get beat. And I mean, we had a training camp maybe the week before, and I mean, we did a brutal, we trained hard on the Saturday, and then we did a brutal, we did a brutal spinning session, and I mean, it was absolutely brutal. And then we went straight into a weight session, and you're kind of going, after you walk, you're going up the road in the bus, and you're kind of going, he goes, if we've went through that, and
he says, stuff in us.
And he goes, we've the stuff, and he goes, we've been told, Mickey was telling us, boys, what's Kerry doing here now? They haven't worked as hard as that there. He goes, because they're thinking of a final. And boys were kind of going, oh, he's right. So plus, we were hungry for success because we knew we had the players that deserved to win All Ireland, but we knew we didn't. We had to do it. And we says, we always wanted a chaff at Kerry, probably from 86, and probably going, because we knew Kerry at that stage, they were there.
Mm-hmm.
They were there. And if you wanted to go anywhere,
you had to knock them off.
You had to knock them off. And that was everything, knocking Kerry off.
Ah, really, really, really good stuff there from Ricey McMenamin. I've been chatting with Kieran Donaghy about that Kerry-Tyrone rivalry. Like, Tommy, like, you're similar to yourself, like at that Muggsy goal that you spoke about, like that was a goal that was replicated in playgrounds across Ireland afterwards. And like I was just watching, like you mentioned the fact that, you know, if you watch old clips back, it kind of reignites a spark in your head about the rivalry. Mm. Like I saw somewhere on Twitter yesterday the wonder score from Brian Doher in 2008. And like same to yourself with the Muggsy goal, it was the context around it. Like I watched the few minutes beforehand, and like I think, if I'm thinking of the same clip, it was like Ryan Mellon, who, by the way, is a coach on the Monaghan Harp senior team.
Ah, is he? Good stuff.
He's involved, and like he played the ball out to Tommy McGuigan, I think, on the wing. Tommy had a bit of a wild strike at goal. Kerry win it back, work it up the pitch, get a goal chance, and then it comes back just some ferocious Tyrone tackling. I think Ricey McMenamin was actually involved, and it comes up to that score with Doher. But it just. When you see clips like that in context, as you said, Tommy, it just reignites the spark, doesn't it?
Yeah, 100%. I think it was Morris Brosnan who put that up yesterday. And I tell you what, I got a couple of tweets off the back, messages off the back of it as well. I had a Kerry man getting in touch saying that Doher definitely took steps. And I think the moment you're talking about there, Mellon definitely has an effort, or he sets up McGuigan. Declan O'Sullivan makes an unbelievable full-length block, goes up the field to Gooch. Gooch sets up a goal chance, it saves. And then Enda McGinley robs Gooch of the ball and starts the counter-attack, which Rice is involved in, you're right, and it leads to Doher's unbelievable score. Doher's points that year were just absolutely sensational. And he was such a hard-working wing forward that it was often, I think, forgotten. Maybe it wasn't, but in retrospect, it feels like it was often forgotten how quality a footballer he was. You know, I know where I stand on that rivalry with Tyrone and Kerry. I'm not sure where you stand, but I presume as an Ulster man, you're leaning with Tyrone. I wonder where... is that the case? Would you be towards Tyrone? Yeah,
there's no love lost between Monaghan and Tyrone, but there's definitely a respect. There's a big respect, and Monaghan don't necessarily like coming up against Tyrone. But like I remember in 2003, you know, Monaghan didn't have much success back then. I think we celebrated beating Armagh in Ulster preliminary round in 2003 because they were the All Ireland champions. But
yeah,
it just shows where Monaghan were, because we won a preliminary round match and we were absolutely over the moon. But I remember welcoming Tyrone. You know, I was there in, you know, outside Emmy Vale, outside my granny's house in Mullabryan in True, when the Tyrone bus came through with, you know, open top bus, Sam Maguire, ready to cross into the border, into Auchnacloy, and just magical scenes. You saw Mickey Hart on the open top bus with his now deceased, sadly, daughter, Michaela, and just some of the scenes were incredible. And Monaghan people got on board with that Tyrone team big time. So it was... Yeah, it's nice to think back on those days and what Tyrone did for Ulster football, because it was massive. We'll get John Duggan's view in just a second. OTB AM, of course, brought to you this morning, as always, by Gillette. Good mornings start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Good morning, John Duggan. How are you keeping?
Jane and Tommy, yourselves?
Keeping well, John, keeping well. You've been listening in to us there, blabbering on about this this Tyrone-Kerry rivalry of old. Perhaps not at the place that it always was, or certainly was in the noughties, but it's still a big rivalry, isn't it?
It's a big rivalry, but Kerry have a clear edge based on the last few years. Kerry have a clear edge on Tyrone, and I expect Kerry to win comfortably on Saturday. I was there for all the matches in the noughties. Kerry were not the best team of the noughties. Tyrone were the best team in the noughties simply by the fact that they beat Kerry three times when it mattered.
Owen Sheehan takes a morning off and we crown them. But I think you're dead right, John, 100%.
So the first game, Kerry didn't know what to do. The year before, Armagh had just kind of caught them. Kerry didn't play too well in the second half of that 2002 final. But Tyrone's ferocity, they just didn't know what to do in that semi-final in 2003. The best game of football I've ever seen live was the Mayo-Dublin 2017 game. The second best was the 2005 final, because this was Kerry at their real, you know, zenith. They won All Ireland in 04 and 06. Seamus Moynihan, you had all the top players, Dara O'Shea, Kieran Donnelly came in later. But in 05, Kerry were an excellent team, and Tyrone beat them with pure football, with brilliant football, with Canavan's goal in that first half, buried it in the corner. They were an excellent team, and I just remember them. I was actually behind I was at the Davin end of Croke Park, and Tyrone were just coming like waves. The wing backs, Philip Jordan, I remember, just coming like waves. He scored a late point. And then in 08, Kerry went to sleep at the start of the second half, and Tyrone got that goal. And I thought Kerry would win. There was a Tommy Walsh, I think, had a chance in the second half. They had the Twin Towers back then, I remember. But Tyrone just was just that surge at the end when they got a few points in a row. And then I remember Kevin Hughes having a great game that day. But that was a shock for me, 08. But that was the one, really, that was almost the decider for the Naughties, and Tyrone won it against the odds. So for me, Tyrone got inside Kerry's heads, and Kerry will always have an asterisk beside them for that decade because of what Tyrone did to them. But at the moment now, I think Kerry are clearly the better team.
Yeah, it was like, we can't forget as well what that Tyrone and what that Armagh team as well did for Ulster football, because like my dad always brags about the fact that in 89, 90, he was kind of saying, you know, Ulster football is coming, and certainly it was, you know, those down teams of McCartan and Pete McGrath and, you know, the Donegal team in 92, the Derry team in 93 were excellent. But then there was kind of another bit of a lull until Armagh won in 02, and then Tyrone followed it up in 03. But you started to think it was going to be this Tyrone-Armagh rivalry for a decade, but the fact that it turned into Tyrone-Kerry and we had those battles, I mean, I would imagine, like, over lockdown, I did a lot of kind of watching OGA matches back and getting pretty nostalgic. I'd imagine there were plenty of Tyrone and Kerry fans and just neutral GAA fans who watched some of those games back, because the ferocity of those occasions, John, was something else.
At the 08 final, at the end, there was a Tyrone, I was in the Tyrone section in the Lower Hogan, and there was a Kerry man amidst the Tyrone fans, and I remember the civility and the everybody shaking hands and commiserating with the Kerry man after Tyrone had won. And I just love that about the GA, that you can mingle, you can mix, there's no segregation of fans, there's no edge in the ground. And it was a really good game of football, and not as good as 05, but they got a confidence. They got a confidence, those Ulster teams, from what the teams had done in the early 90s. Down were traditionally the best team out of Ulster back to 1960, 68. And once they broke through in 91, I think when Donegal, Derry made their breakthroughs, it gave the likes of Armagh and Tyrone confidence that they could do it. But I don't think Tyrone actually benefited more from Armagh. But I don't think Tyrone would have won the All-Ireland if Armagh hadn't won it. But then it ended up that Armagh only won one, and Armagh haven't won an Ulster since 2008. And Tyrone are the team who've kept going through Ulster over the last 15 years, not Armagh.
Yeah, loads of good content as well still to come on Off the Ball. Check out the podcast section for plenty of more build-up for Tyrone Kerry. And there's also a great panel with yourself, John, for people who want to seek it out. The Saturday panel a couple of months back with James McCartan, with Declan Boner and with Joe Brawley, looking back on that golden era of Ulster football in the early 90s. So the OTB Sports app, you can search, or wherever you get your podcast as well. John, what else is happening in the world of sport this morning?
Well, Alan Keane has got a real chance of a medal now in the Paralympics. So SBH 100 metres breaststroke in Tokyo, she qualified in first place from the heats. There's a lady as well called Rachel Pascoe, who also was very close to Ellen Keane in that heat. But between the two of them, there are four seconds clear of the rest. So Ellen Keane got a bronze in Rio in 2016. She's hoping to go better than 5 years ago. Back in the pool at 11:40 a.m. this morning, Irish time, 1 minute 21.71 seconds, qualifying in first place from the heats. And the 16-year-old swimmer from Limerick, Roisin Éireann, qualifying for another final, finishing third in her heat in the S13 100 metres backstroke, returning just after 11 a.m. Irish time. The Rio gold medal winning cyclists Katie George Dunleavy, Eve McChrystal, finished 6th in the B1000 metres time trial earlier this morning. Ronan Grimes 15th in the C45 100 metres time trial. Colin Judge receiving a walkover in a scheduled Class 3 table tennis singles match. He's back in action tomorrow. Rosemary Gaffney making her Paralympic debut at the age of 62 later in the equestrian Grade 4 individual test. Tamsin Adamson competing in the Grade 5 individual test after 12:30 Irish time. Stephen Kenny, not unlucky general, is he, at the moment? Callum Robinson has been ruled out of the World Cup qualifiers with Portugal and Azerbaijan after contracting COVID-19 for a second time. Stephen Kenny naming a squad later this afternoon. Arsenal and Southampton big winners in the League Cup in England last night. Arsenal 6-0 victors over West Brom. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang with a hat-trick, and Southampton beat Newport by 8-0. Burnley defeated Newcastle on penalties at St James's Park. The draw has been made for the third round. David Moyes going back to Old Trafford. West Ham visiting Manchester United. Liverpool are going to go to Norwich. Holders Manchester City playing Wickham. We also have Chelsea facing Aston Villa. Among the pick of the other ties, Tottenham going to Wolves. Arsenal playing Wimbledon. Everton away to QPR. And Leeds also on the road away to Fulham. Stephen Bradley hoping for good tidings with Shamrock Rovers tonight. 4-2 down from the first leg against Flora Tallinn in Estonia. Ahead of this match at Tallaght Stadium, 7:45 kickoff. No away goals, remember. They're hoping to get into the group stage of the UEFA Conference League. $3 million on the line. Can they overturn those two goals? Spurs playing Pacas de Ferreira, 1-0 down. Harry Kane set to feature after committing himself to the club. Pep Guardiola has said he's going to leave Manchester City in 2023. He wants a break by that stage. I think that's not a bad thing because it gives them a focus now, win the Champions League in the next couple of years. He says he wants to manage an international team after taking a break. City in the draw for the group stage of the Champions League at 5 o'clock in Istanbul today with Man United, Liverpool and the holders Chelsea. Celtic in Europa League playoff action tonight, 2-0 up against AZ going into their match in the Netherlands, which has got a 7:15 kickoff. Rangers 1-0 up on Alashkert going into their match in Armenia. That kicks off at 4 o'clock Irish time. The penultimate leg of the FedEx Cup in Baltimore today at the BMW Championship with Rory McIlroy and Shane Lowry involved. The European Tour has the Omega European Masters and racing today, lads. The first off at Tipperary is at 4:15.
John, I'll get into your virtual insanity golf tips for the weekend in just a second, but as a Tottenham Hotspur fan, I have to mention Harry Kane, of course, and his latest tweet. It was incredible to see the reception from the Spurs fans on Sunday and to read some of the messages of support I've had in the last few weeks. I will be staying at Tottenham this summer and will be 100% focused on helping the team achieve success. Come on, you Spurs. John, what do you make of all this? I mean, gentlemen's agreements don't mean much anymore, but at least Harry's drawn a line under this for now.
Well, my column last week for OTB Sports and on the OTB app is generally better than my golf predictions at the moment. I said Harry Kane messed this up. He did mess it up. He's trapped. You can't go on strike if you sign a 6-year deal without a release clause for $200,000 a week. There's a guilt trip. He is a very professional footballer, generally, with his relationship with the fans. And the fans are beginning to turn on him. So he's got to get his head down and do it, because ultimately Daniel Levy, the brilliant businessman that he is, whether he's a football businessman is open to conjecture. But as a businessman, he has all the control. The reason why he's got the control, Harry Kane was badly advised in his contract. He signed a 6-year contract without a release clause. Gentlemen's agreements. This is not the Mafia movie. It's not Marlon Brando. It's not The Godfather, where we have our word and we have our handshake and all that kind of thing. It's about a legal contract and nothing else. Daniel Levy is a reasonable man, but Daniel Levy sees Ben White going for $50 million. He sees Jack Grealish going for $100 million. He sees Harry Kane, leading goal scorer last season, leading player with assists, and saying, maybe I've got a valuation here of $150 million. Man City are not short of cash. PSG are not short of cash. I have an asset here. I have a price on my asset. I'm not going to sell him for less than what I think. That is the way he thinks, Daniel Levy. So he would have put a valuation, say, of 150 on Kane. City weren't going to match that. There was talk of 75 plus add-ons for City. Also, I think Miguel Delaney made a good point. Is Kane the type of player Pep Guardiola wants? Because Kane is a bit more of a player now who's drifting into a number 10 role. He's 28 years of age. Does Pep want more of a straight nine? If he's looking for a striker to replace Aguero at City, does he even need one with the way Ferran Torres is playing at the moment? But Harry Kane has been trapped by his own decision making, and he just has to get the head down. And the problem for Kane is now that there's a couple of things here. There's a problem for Spurs in that next season, Kane's fee, his value could have depreciated significantly. I don't know why Man United didn't go in for Kane. I think Man United need a player like him, and they got a chance for the title. I think they're a little bit short at the moment. As the Spurs, Daniel Levy's taking a risk in that Kane might not be worth 150 million next season. But by next season, by next summer, Mbappe will be available. It seems like the portent is that he's going to go to Real, and then Haaland will be available. Will City prefer to sign someone like Haaland rather than Harry Kane if they don't win the Champions League this season? So Harry Kane is in a tricky position, and from his perspective, you can understand his frustration that Spurs have not progressed. They were second in the league in 2017. They reached the Champions League final in 2019. They were seventh last season. Nuno's got a rebuilding job to do. So it feels probably for Harry Kane that they're back to square one. But unfortunately, if you sign a six-year deal the way he did, and you don't have all the lowers in and sorting out all the little clauses, then you're in this position that you don't have anywhere to go.
Yeah. Tricky position for sure, as you said. Like, he's 28 years of age, so no doubt he wants to finish his career with a few trophies, and he's going to probably,
which is why Daniel Levy, from a football perspective, you have to question his tenure at Spurs. From a football perspective, they've won one trophy in 20 years, the 2008 League Cup. Look at the amount of trophies Chelsea have won. But as a business, Spurs were bought for 22 million in 2000, 22 million sterling. Their valuation now is 2 billion. They're the 10th richest club in the world, according to Forbes.
Yeah, this is the thing. Get in touch with the Spurs fans. Leave us a comment in all of our streams and let us know what you think. Daniel Levy, Harry Kane, whose corner are you in for this one? And where will he head when he ultimately does, you would imagine, leave Tottenham Hotspur at some point? John, Virtual Insanity this morning, you're looking at the BMW Championship on the PGA Tour in Maryland. Who's taking your fancy this weekend?
The rationale is on otbsports.com and on the OTB app. I'll just breeze through these quickly. The headliner is Justin Thomas. 4 each way, 20-1 for Justin Thomas. 64 and 68 to win the Players' Championship in March. Fourth last week, he's back in form, Justin Thomas, great ball striker. He is a born winner, 14 wins on the PGA Tour. Justin Thomas, 4 each way, 20-1 is the headliner. You get a fifth of the odds, the first seven places. Sam Burns, 50-1 for 3 each way. Sam Burns has gone from 154th in the world at the end of last year to 25th. Go figure that. All-round game is excellent. 14th in the stats that regard. Second two tournaments ago for Sam Burns. 3 each way at 50-1. Corey Connors, who is from Listowel in Ontario. No Kerry connections, though. 2 each way at 40-1 for Corey Connors. Fourth in ball striking. 8th in strokes gained approach this year. 62 last week in the third round of the Northern Trust. I think he's due a win. Corey Connors for 2 each way at 40-1. Brian Harman at 100-1. 2 each way for him. Very few players have got a course form here at Caves Valley, but he does. In the 2007 Palmer Cup at the course, Brian Harman won all of his matches. That was a Tom Fazio design, and he's won at a Tom Fazio design at Quail Hollow. 5 top tens this season. Recent form isn't too great, but he has bounced back out of the blue before. Brian Harman has got course experience for 2 each way at 100-1. And Emiliano Grillo from Argentina at 125-1 for €1.50 each way is a brilliant ball striker. Played well at the Open Championship, played well at the Barracuda Championship recently. Not the best putter, but if it is a ball striker's course this weekend, I think it might be at 150-1. 150, actually, the price has gone up since I even said it. 150-1 for Emiliano Grillo. Brian Harman's got the course form. Corey Connors is due a win. Sam Burns is a really rising star that's completely underrated, and the headliner this week on Virtual Insanity, Justin Thomas, 14 PGA Tour titles, could be 15 by Sunday.
Come on, JT, let's go. John, great stuff. All right, lads, this morning.
Take
thanks
care.
A million.
Cheers.
Good stuff. John Logan there with Virtual Insanity and with the Sports Bullet and everything else besides as well. Loads of great insight as per usual. Tommy, it's that time where I try to convince you of something this morning on OTBAM on this Thursday morning. It's 7:58 a.m. I'm going to try and convince you preemptively, because it hasn't happened yet, but I'm flying to Belgium later on this afternoon with a few friends, and we're going to the Belgian Grand Prix in Spa on Sunday. So it's going to be my first experience of a Formula One event, my first experience of a live race.
Oh, is it? Is it your first one? Okay.
First one. I'm kind of I feel like a bit of a blow-in, a bit of a newbie, like the Drive to Survive series on Netflix kind of really reignited my interest in Formula One. And by all means, I'm not a technical engineering expert in terms of Formula One, but I enjoy the personalities, I enjoy the characters, I enjoy the race, I enjoy the coverage as well. It has to be said, the coverage on television on Sky Sports is excellent for Formula One. When you can hear the team radios, you can hear them arguing with each other, driver and engineer. It really is fascinating. But Tommy, I'm going to convince you and tell you why Formula One is perhaps the best live experience before I've even done it this weekend. But the money in excess, Tommy, I'm going to start off with. So there are gold, silver and bronze passes for us this weekend in Belgium. Of course, we're down with the cockroaches in third class, the bronze tickets. Still not cheap. I think it was maybe upward of 150 quid for a bronze ticket. And it kind of just gets you a little bit crappier view than the silver. And of course, then silver is a little bit crappier than gold. But it's still, I think there's platinum and VIP tickets as well. But I just love... Of course there are. Like, but it's not going to happen for me just yet. But I love this excess. There's no prawn sandwich brigade with us. Like, the bronze tickets are going to be excellent still. But there's just something about Formula One and the excess. I've got a couple of photographs here I want to bring on screen. There was a Monaco Grand Prix in 2006. I can't believe this was 15 years ago. Kimi Raikkonen, his heat shield blew up at the Monaco Grand Prix. So this is him walking away from the track in the first photograph. And if you go to the next photograph, you'll see the jetties behind him. He walks directly from the track. He doesn't even get changed onto his yacht. And then we'll see photo three, a nice pixelated close-up photograph of him sitting on his yacht. And I can tell you he was drinking a beer there as well. So 2006, Monaco Grand Prix, Kimi Raikkonen, what a character, going straight to his yacht after his heat shield blew up. That just shows the heat or the money in excess in Formula One. That's reason one, Tommy. Reason two, kind of similar, the celebrities. So there was a moment in Formula One Grand Prix, and I think it was 2018, the Canadian Grand Prix. Sometimes a celebrity is asked to wave the checkered flag at the end of the race, kind of a little token gesture, something to put on your CV, I guess. Winnie Harlow, who I'm told is a Canadian model, close friend of Lewis Hamilton as well, waved the flag, as we'll see in the photograph here, on lap 69, one lap before the scheduled 70-lap race limit. She was instructed to do so by the official known as the starter. She waved at a lap early. You can tell by her facial expression there, she's like, oh crap, I've messed up. I've waved this flag one lap early. The race wasn't over, but because the cars, of course, see the flag and essentially are thinking their heads, okay, this race is over, the cars start to slow down. So in the end, the result was taken from the 68th lap, as per the regulations. There was no real significant changes in position, but it did mean Daniel Ricciardo lost his fastest lap to his teammate at that time, Max Verstappen. So it was just an awkward moment where you're like, lads, leave the celebrities out of it. But it's moments like that that make it interesting. There's been different moments as well, Tommy, over the years in the pit lane. Martin Brundle, the Sky reporter, getting completely rebuffed by Venus Williams. He went up to talk to her live on air and she just stared at him up and down. Quentin Tarantino just started spouting absolute nonsense out of his mouth in the pit lane 1 year. Ozzy Osbourne, quite similar in Canada in 2003.
This is all great stuff, Shane, but I'm very aware of the fact that it's all happening outside of the sport itself. You're going to have to do a bit more work here now to convince me to make time for Formula One on my schedule.
Okay, fair. Number three, Tommy, the noise of the cars. This is very much involved in the sport, the decibel levels, I have to tell you. The Seattle Seahawks, a couple of years ago, I remember being in the news, got so noisy at one of their NFL games that they set off seismographs nearby that register earthquakes, set a Guinness World Record as well. But Formula One, myself and my mates in the WhatsApp group yesterday for this weekend, one of the lads put in, what are we going to do about air protection? And I hadn't thought of it. We do need to bring air protection with us because it's that kind of sensory experience. So there was a study done, Tommy, don't ever tell us we don't get scientific here on O2BAM, but there was a doctoral candidate in acoustical engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. His name was Craig Dolder a few years ago, where he measured sound levels at three locations on a Formula One racetrack. He found that the loudest spot, the peak noise levels, were almost 140 decibels, or just below those known to cause permanent hearing loss. And cumulative noise levels of those sustained over a length of time soared well above what the Occupational Safety and Health Administration in America considers safe for a normal workday. So there's parts of this lap, Tommy, that put people above a safe level of noise exposure. So people sitting at the noisiest location would get 85 times their daily noise dosage if they sat through an entire race with no ear protection. So it shows you how important it is, and that is something I'm looking forward to, the wind of the cars going, flying in our face as they go past, and the noise. So there you go. There's number three for you, Tommy.
Okay. Keep going, Shane, because I need a bit more work now to convince me to get stuck into Formula One.
I thought I was on a roll there, but you're killing me. You're killing my confidence.
You kind of got me earlier on, but I'm just going to need a bit more when it comes okay. to what's happening on the actual tracks. What's actually happening in the sport?
Fair. Well, specifically with this track on Sunday, and the reason why we probably chose the Belgian Grand Prix as our first Grand Prix, this Spa circuit, set in the Ardennes Forest, beautiful region, I'm told, of Belgium, and I can't wait to find that out for myself. For many people, there's a lot of World War II history as well there. Bastogne was a city that saw a lot of fighting in the Ardennes Forest region. You'll see a lot of it in Band of Brothers as well, but you see in that photograph on screen, that's Max Verstappen and the wall of orange behind him, because it's kind of like a home circuit for Max Verstappen, the Belgian Grand Prix. Spa has been one of those races that thousands of Dutch fans show up to. I cannot wait for that absolute Max Verstappen mania. He's got a Belgian mother as well, Max Verstappen. And Stoffel van Dorn, the Belgian, no longer, of course, racing in Formula 1. So he's probably the closest thing, Max Verstappen, to a home driver. So to experience that absolute mania, Beatlemania in some ways, for Max Verstappen. There's a Max Verstappen shop, I'm told, at the Spa circuit as well, such is his popularity. But the circuit as well, Tommy, this Spa circuit, iconic in the world of Formula 1. It's the longest track in this season's calendar as well. The Eau Rouge, iconic corner, the Radion, the Pouhon, spectacular as well. Very challenging as well. You've got the Kemmel Straight, chicanes like the Le Combe, just different parts of it that are just famous for Formula 1 and encouraging of overtaking as well, which is important because the Monaco Grand Prix, quite tight, quite constrained street. It's a street race and tough to overtake. On this one, this circuit in Belgium, we're going to see lots of overtaking, I hope. And changeable weather as well. It's a venue that can see high summer temperatures. It can drop as well in temperature. It can rain very, very often. Some of the most dramatic races in Formula 1 have taken place at this track, Tommy. So in 2008, Felipe Massa won an incredible race over Lewis Hamilton and Kimi Raikkonen. 1998 was one of the most expensive crashes in Formula 1 history. The majority of the grid caught in a bit of an incident on the rundown from La Source. So the track, Tommy, and what we're going to see on Sunday is my reason for the Formula 1 being an unbelievable experience. And reason five, and the last one, Tommy, is I've spouted about this man on the show before, the Australian driver. He now races for McLaren, Daniel Ricciardo. What a character. And the reason why Netflix's Drive to Survive really drew me in. He was the star of the show, to be honest with you. He was just something else. I don't care that I'd be paying €15 for a pint. I don't care that I'd be paying through the nose for Belgian truffles and Belgian chips on the street and everything else that Brussels and Liège have to offer, because I have the chance of seeing Daniel Ricciardo's pretty face in person. We saw the photograph of him doing a shoey there, his famous shoey celebration when he wins a race, of pouring beer or the champagne into a cup. It could be a beer. I don't know which he does, into his shoe. Sweaty shoe, no doubt, after taking part in the Formula One, and he drinks it. When he was a driver for Renault a few years ago, I was tempted to buy a Renault jersey, and I did. I bought a Renault T-shirt, and then he left. Such is the way Formula One happens. But now he's racing for McLaren. So this Sunday, I'm hoping to buy a McLaren hat, McLaren T-shirt, and support them all the way, himself and Lando Norris. So Tommy, those are my five reasons. I hope I've convinced you, and that is why I think Formula One racing is up there with perhaps the best in-person fan experiences. What do you think?
Shane, I'm going to have to be convinced, so I'm going to tune in on Sunday. I'm going to follow your Instagram over the weekend because I know you're going to be posting stuff there when you're at the race. So I'm going to tune in. I want to be convinced. So you've kind of won me over with the last two there. So I'm going to watch on Sunday. I have to be honest, I haven't caught the bug yet. But maybe that's because I haven't got stuck into Drive to Survive. So give me a bit more time and I'll come back to you on it. But yeah, you're going to have an unbelievable time. It sounds like it's going to be an amazing experience.
Oh, I can't wait. Even just to get on an airplane for the first time in I don't know how long, later on this afternoon, is going to be incredible. So yeah, I can't wait for that. The Belgian Grand Prix on Sunday. You can tune in and watch it. 8:08 a.m. this morning on OTB AM this Thursday morning. We've still got a packed show to come on OTB AM with myself and Tommy. We'll hear from Gareth Roberts ahead of Chelsea against Liverpool. Gareth, of course, from the Anfield Wrap. We're talking TV with Sue Murphy. And up next, we're talking to Cork star Sean Powder about how to face Kerry.
OTB AM.
Yeah, you're right. Welcome back to OTB AM on this Thursday morning. Shane and Tommy with you right through until 10 a.m. It's 8:11 a.m. As things stand this morning. Delighted to welcome to the show this morning the current Cork senior footballer, Sean Powder. Morning, Sean.
Morning, how are you?
Keeping well, Sean, keeping well. We decided to get you on, of course, to talk about your own county in Cork, and we'll get to them in a bit. But Kerry Tyrone this weekend, myself and Tommy were chatting about the rivalry between the two over the years and what a game to look forward to. But what's the vibe down there? I know, like, yourselves having played Kerry this year, they're a different animal this year, it has to be said.
Yeah, compared to like last year, you know, where we beat them down the park. We kind of thought going into Killarney, we had another shot at them, but they blew us away after 15 minutes. They knew everything we wanted to do, and they just, yeah, as you said, they're at a different level this year. But I think like, Tyrone, go on, yeah, sorry.
No, fire away. Like, I'm just going to say, like, I guess, what's changed between that Kerry team last year and this year? Like, have they developed? Have they improved? Like, they've clearly come on in leaps and bounds, but is there anything tangible that you've noticed or picked up on?
I think they're playing with six out now forwards, because I remember last year before the game in the park, they brought off Stephen O'Brien and put on Brian Begley. Mm. And that was the kind of, okay, 1-0 to us, like, they kind of fear us here. But now they're playing with six out now forwards, and you need six out and out defenders to mark them. And there's a lot of teams that don't have the quality of defenders as to match the quality of forwards they have.
Did you feel, Sean, last November, say, when you were building up to that game, there was so much talk about Kerry again. Did you feel like the way that Kerry set up, that they may have had an eye on Dublin that day?
Yeah, and that was in the back of our minds. Like, they're not even thinking about us. And like, all the papers were Kerry Dublin. Mm. And they were just kind of skipping over us. And that was a kind of motivation, and we used it as motivation. But I think this year they were like, no, we're focused on Cork now, and we'll get over Cork and focus on the next team after that. And I think they did that very well, to be fair to them.
Yeah, one of the things we kind of spoke about earlier in the year was it looked like Kerry were playing with a bit of anger this year. You obviously had that unbelievable win. It really obviously stung them as a team. Like, we know when we look at David Clifford and Sean O'Shea that they are going to be two of the most important players over the next decade. And I suppose in Kerry, they're probably looking at Cork and they're saying that you're on the rise as well, but it just hasn't happened yet at senior level. Like, you've had a couple of big results over the last couple of years, and in an underage level, you're seeing it coming, but it just hasn't come to fruition yet at senior level. Kerry this year looked like they were angry. And I think what you're saying there about the six forwards, that was a major thing for them this year. Getting Paul Gainey out to wing forward and moving the way he's going, and the addition of Paddy Clifford. When you were in that defence a couple of weeks ago in Killarney, what felt different about playing that six up front? Like, did it just feel like it was coming at you from all angles?
Yeah, literally, even like Begley scored, I think Begley scored 1-2 or something, and Thomas Sullivan got 2 points. Like, when your defenders are doing that, there's not much. You try and mark the forward, but if they're running up the pitch, you have to go and mark the danger as well. Like, so you have to leave Sean O'Shea a couple of times, and then he just clips over points. But I think one of the main differences was they went after us rather than they sat back. Like, I remember, like, in this game, I attacked once and I got turned over, and Sean O'Shea had the ball in the back of the net. Well, if that was November in the park, he tracked me back the whole pitch. Like, so I feel like they were given permission to not track back and get us in the counter attack, and they did that to us. Like,
that's interesting. What worked that November? Because it's obviously a different Kerry team from what we're seeing, but I would also make the argument that Kerry haven't fully been tested yet. Like, they were going in for Cork. It was clear against Tipperary played quite defensively, and once Gavin White broke the cover and set up Clifford for that goal, it seemed like Tip were broken a wee bit. With Clare actually kept them to a decent level for about 45-50 minutes. They just couldn't get the scores on the board to do the damage. So it doesn't feel like Kerry have faced a huge challenge so far this year. What worked in 2020? Like, to my own untrained eye, it looked like your own direct running and your own wing backs and the kind of surging runs from midfield is what caused the damage.
Yeah, like, we were told to run at them, because when you run at them, they're not as strong as other defences. But the thing with us, we couldn't get the ball away from the kickouts, because they had such a high press in the kickouts. They put four in the full forward line, four and a half back line, and a half forward line as well, and we just couldn't get the ball out. So they were just suffocating us, and any time we did get the ball, we were just surrounded by Kerry men. But like, now Morgan's a different kettle of fish, so I wonder will they be as aggressive at the weekend with him.
Shane, yeah, I don't know if you heard Rory Began during the week, but the conversation we got Began on earlier in the week, just to kind of talk about the Morgan factor and what he can bring to it. Shane, you'd have obviously seen Morgan and Began up against each other in that Ulster final in Croke Park. Like, that was incredible to watch. So I'd say Niall Morgan is going to have a big impact in this game.
Would you be along those lines, Sean? Like, I 100%, Tommy. Like, it was actually terrifying to watch. I don't know how you feel as a defender, how you would feel as a defender, Sean, like, when your goalkeeper does that. Is that just the way Gaelic football is headed? Is that just the way we are at the moment?
I don't think it's a Micheál Martin's locker, is it?
No, I don't think Micheál will be up tackling, turning over balls, but it does look like it's kind of leaning towards that way, adding a kind of extra player. But I played with Niall Morgan with the international rules, and he is a top class goalie. Like, so I'm kind of looking forward to see how Kerry will try and go after him, or how he will go after Kerry.
Yeah, the thing is, though, Morgan has that league game possibly in his head. Like, he didn't have his greatest day that day, and I know he probably got a bit of a treatment afterwards with Logan Adair. I think he spoke about that. There was words. But, like, he's going to have to take a chance this weekend. Like, that's the thing with Tyrone. They can't just sit back defensively. You boys took a chance, and I think you probably had a chip on your shoulder in 2020. What do you think Tyrone can do this weekend? That let's take the game on face value. It's hard to know how much COVID has impacted the squad and what sort of a team they're going to have. But if you were taking this game on face value, how would you get Tyrone set up?
I think one of the main things is you have to follow Paddy Clifford around the place, like, because he's kind of the link between defence and attack for them. And, like, I think Paddy's given Shawnee and David Clifford the license to stay up top and link the play between the two boys. So I'd have to, like, if I was their manager now, I'd just tag Paddy Clifford wherever he goes, and just, like, don't let them get 2 or 3 points ahead, because that's where they'll kill you. Like, but it's easier said than done.
Yeah. No. It felt like that. I heard a remark. It was Colin Collins say that Paddy Clifford has the ball in his hand so quickly that it shouldn't even count as a possession. It's in his hands and it's gone. But I actually think Clifford hasn't fully been tested yet at inter-county level. Like, I think you're right. I think I presume when you boys are setting up, there's such a job in, okay, who's taking David Clifford? Who's taking Sean O'Shea? That, you know, when they have their six forwards out there, it's like when you get down to tagging Paddy Clifford, it's maybe just a little bit further. But I suppose everyone will have learned their lesson by this stage. So Tyrone will be ready to go on that. How about the half back line that Kerry have set up with this year? Can they be got at in defence? Like, Tyrone, we know that Tyrone have the right profile of player for counter-attacking football. They have the likes of Sludden, Myler, McGeary, McKernan, boys who can get deep and break with the ball. Is that some way, like, that would have been similar to yourselves? You would have had a lot of legs in midfield and the half back line. Is that something that Tyrone can use?
Yeah, like, one of the main weaknesses in Kerry is when you run at them, but their strength is when they turn you over. They just go, like, and you saw that with Begley's goal and a couple of Thomas Sullivan's points. When they turn you over, they just run at you. But, like, we got most of our joy in 2020 when we just ran straight at them and said, man on man, let's have a crack here. And I think Tyrone will have to do the same at the weekend. And, like, they have the players. They have McKenna, McShane, like, and Matty Donnelly, like, they're top inter-county players. Like,
you'd have played international rules at McKenna as well. What do you make of him as a footballer? Like, where would you think he should play? Because he's obviously a box office footballer. He's had big moments this year. But, like, it's hard to know what his actual role should be.
In the international rules, he was playing half-back and he dominated half-back. So if I was putting him, I'd play him half-back and just leave him run up and down the pitch, because he's a pure out-and-out athlete. Like,
The something just to pick up on Tommy was talking about there in terms of man mark, and it kind of struck me after Tommy spoke to Stephen Cohen in advance of this All Ireland final for Mayo, and, like, the issue of man marking and picking up a player at the start of the game. Like, when you were playing Kerry earlier this year, Sean, and when these Tyrone players line up to play Kerry, like, Stephen Cohen spoke about the fact that the nature of championship football is that you might have an idea of who you're marking at the start of the match, but over the course of that 70, 80 minutes, you're essentially marking 4 or 5, perhaps even 6 different players. Like, did you find that again when you were playing against Kerry, for example, that, you know, you might have gone into the game with the idea of man marking a particular player and it just did not work out that way?
Yeah, like, he's bang on there, like, because with Kerry, their movement is just ridiculous. So you're trying to, like, minimise the work you're doing while trying to having a bit of energy to go forward. So we'd be switching the whole time. But it's extremely difficult when the movement is top class, like which Kerry's movement is. But like as Stephen said, it's you go in marking, say, Sean O'Shea, but you could end up marking Paddy Clifford for 10 minutes, then going on to David Clifford for 5 minutes. It is class to test yourself against the best, but it's also difficult to concentrate on who's on who and stuff.
It sounds terrible, though, marking those three lads across an afternoon.
Yeah.
Shane, just what we were saying earlier on about, Sean, we were talking about the Tyrone-Kerry rivalry of the noughties earlier, and we were talking about, I suppose, Andy Moran actually made the point, we're going to play the clip a little later, that Tyrone's success in the noughties, people kind of mistake it that it was built on defence. Yes, they were ferocious tacklers. Yes, they hit you harder, and they probably, the cornerbacks and the fullbacks probably treated you a little differently or harsher than anyone else. But they were built on attackers. They were built on Canavan, Muggsy, Stephen O'Neill, Brian Duher, Brian McGuigan, Ryan Mellon, Jared Cavlin, like Sean Kavanagh. Do you know what I mean? Like they were always built on exceptional attackers. And when you name out that Tyrone attack, and I know I named maybe 8 or 9 players there, there's a real variety in the type of forwards. Maybe the one thing they're missing was a Donaghy or a Tommy Welch, but like they had it everywhere else. They could mix it up. Like with Brian McGuigan, you had such, you know, vision. With Muggsy and Canavan, such instinct inside. Stephen O'Neill could score from anywhere. That Kerry front six has a shocking amount of variety as well. And then if you add to it, who are the next men in? Tommy Welch is coming off the bench. Kenyon Spillane is coming off the bench. When you're, as Shane is asking the question there about changing markers, the different prospects and testing yourself, getting right for that as a defender must be tough. Like, I know I could have Paddy in my area for 10 minutes. I could have Sean O'Shea. How are you getting yourself right for that? How are you getting yourself in the mentality to be able to do that?
It is difficult, like, but you have to kind of, like, the night before I'd always visualise marking the players who I know I'm going to mark, and potentially, like, I know I could mark Paddy Clifford, so I visualise for 5 or 6 minutes tackling him and that kind of stuff. But I don't think you can prepare because you don't know what's going to happen in Championship football. Like, Spillane was in after 15 minutes against us.
Yeah.
And we were expecting him 20 minutes to go, as he did in all the other games. But it is difficult, I think that's one of the main challenges of intercounty football is kind of getting your head right to accept anything that's going to be thrown at you.
100%.
The unpredictability of Championship football. Like, if we were to try and make an argument for Tyrone to win this game, Sean, or even for Kerry to lose it, whichever way you want to put it, like, I saw Martin Brennan in the Irish Independent this week kind of asking the question, are this Kerry team overrated? Like, it's a fortnight later than scheduled for Kerry. They haven't had a game for 5 weeks. And even then, you know, with all respect, the Munster final wasn't the push that maybe, for example, the Dubs might give them. Like, could Kerry come in cold? Like, is there any argument you can make that maybe Kerry will be finding it difficult to get over the line on Saturday?
I'd love to say they will find it difficult, but I don't see it happening. I think we caught them cold in 2020, and I don't think they'll be caught cold again. But I do think if Tyrone get their kick out press or their kick outs right, there's a lot of joy in behind the defence when you do get it away, like, because they left just Brian Hurley and Michael Hurley unmarked when we were taking their kick outs. Like, so I feel if they do the same with Tyrone will just bomb it into the lads inside. Like,
and the two lads made hay in that first 15 minutes, Sean. Like, you were right in that game.
Yeah, I think Curly scored 1, 2 or 3 in the first 15-20 minutes, but then they kind of copped on and they started winning breaks and stuff. But if Tyrone get their kickouts right, I feel like there's a game on here. Like,
it's incredible when you think that it's well over 10 years, sorry Shane, well over 10 years since Cork won their last All-Ireland football title. I know shortly after that, Aidan Walsh was on a very strong team that had done well at under-21 level. But over the last couple of years, Sean, there was the under-20 title in 2019. They obviously got the under-20 final last year as well in 2020 that they lost to Kerry. But this year, in terms of the hurling and the football, there was a clean sweep at minor level and there's been real success there at under-17 level over the last couple of years. What's it like being a part of an inter-county team when there's that sort of transition going on, that you know that there's footballers coming through? There might be some other lads that are maybe stepping away, but it's quite a young profile of a team there in Cork at the minute and you're trying something different. Is it exciting to be a part of something like that?
Yeah, like When I joined the panel, there were the likes of Donnchadh O'Connor, Daniel Goodling. So like when you're looking up to those kind of players, you dream of playing with them, like, and when you are eventually there, it's class. But I don't think the players nowadays have the kind of same like role models, I'd say. So I feel like now I'd be someone's role models, as say. So like it is exciting to kind of help young fellas in, and I do feel like there is serious potential in Cork football, and I feel like in the next coming years we can go places. Like,
what have you found is the important thing? Like, because we're seeing it with Offaly now with their young lads, they're going to be trying to bring through that under 20 team. In I'm a Meath man. I don't know if I haven't mentioned it today so far, but like in Meath, there's that. You know, they've been asleep at the wheel for 10, 12 years, you could say, 15 years, 20 years, we'll say. How do you bridge it? How do you add those three or four players in? What would you say is the key thing for young players coming into a squad or even for a management team to bring players in? What's the most important thing to get young lads in?
I think it's just belief as well. There seems to be a lack of belief with Cork football. When we're going up against the likes of Dublin, Kerry, some people just don't believe we should be there. While I personally believe every game we go into, we will win. And I know I put it out in the Examiner the week before the Kerry game.
Yeah,
100. I genuinely believe we will win. And I got a lot of stick for that after, to be fair.
Did you?
Yeah. But like, if I went into a game believing I was going to lose, I wouldn't have bothered. Like,
and when you're getting stick, I presume that's from outside the camp. It's not necessarily inside.
Oh yeah, not inside the camp. No.
Yeah, when you're trying to foster down that, like, I suppose that mentality, like, Cork shouldn't be looking at that game as if they're, I suppose, a smaller country club going up against the big town club or something like that. How are you able to generate that, inspire that sort of reaction with teammates and I suppose the rest of it? It's not even the teammates you're trying to inspire. It's nearly the Cork public you're trying to inspire, because if you look at a county like Tyrone, they're probably being written off all around this week, but you just know that Tyrone don't care, and Tyrone will use that in a positive way. Like, Cork can look at the last couple of years of underage success and fully believe that there's something on the horizon here.
Yeah, like there is, like player like Brian Hart, you know, Cathal O'Mahony, they've all won under 20 All-Irelands, and hopefully now we love the likes of Jack Callan, Brian Hayes, David Buckley, like that kind of calibre of players stepping up in the next, hopefully next year or the year after. So like there is the talent there. It's just finally bring them all together and kind of fighting for one cause, which is Cork football. Like,
yeah, I think one of the things that stuck with me after the Dublin Mayo game was Andy Moran pointing out the young lads that were left on the pitch at the end of the game. They had beaten Dublin in a 2016 under-21 All-Ireland final, and Andy was saying you just knew that the likes of Jimmy O'Connor was sizing up someone like Tom Lahiff and going, I've beaten this guy before, I know I have. Stephen Cohen, Conor O'Shea, Conor Loftus, they'd beaten them before. So I think if those Cork lads come through and they have it in their bones that they've beaten Kerry, there'll be no fear. So look, best of luck with that over the next couple of years, and thanks for joining us this morning, Sean.
Thanks very much.
Great stuff. Yeah, thanks a million, Sean. Really good insight there from Sean Powder, the current Cork senior inter-county footballer. Really, really good stuff. OTBM, of course, brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. It's 8:29. It's just gone 8:30 on this Thursday morning. Tommy, yourself and Andy Moore and Paddy Andrews have been also diving a bit deeper into this Kerry Tyrone game on Saturday.
100%, Shane. It's the feature of episode 16 of the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy. We had a huge listenership naturally enough after the Dublin Mayo game. You had Paddy, I suppose it was a crushing defeat for Dublin in many ways, not that a huge amount of people had sympathy for them, and obviously for Mayo it was a huge moment, and they probably buried a couple of demons that they had probably suffered over the last 7-8 years from 2012 onwards. So this week we got stuck into Kerry Tyrone. We're going to start off here with I had forgotten that Mayo had actually come up against that great Tyrone team a couple of times, and Andy himself came up against Ricey. So we'll start off with that, and we'll end with the craft of scoring goals.
We did. We remember my little photo.
Is there not a photo of Ricey giving you a dig? Is that a dig? He's giving you a little rabbit punch in the head.
He gave me a little rabbit punch.
You tweet. Must be giving some back, though.
tweet that photo. That was it's a brilliant photo.
I don't know why he was in there. I was just delighted to be alive. I was delighted to be there.
It was a brilliant photo.
that was a great day. It was Canavan was injured, and I just remember Maha and Mikhail got their tactics spot on. We put Ronan McGarity out on Sean Kavanagh. Sean Kavanagh used to be 9 at 8 or 9, but he used to play at 12. And we put
brilliant.
Yeah. So I don't know why he was trying to quiet me, as I said, but yeah. So listen, it was we just got our tactics spot on, and we played them. We played them in Note 8. I did horrible experience in Note 8. I was useless in the game. Sean Kavanagh, Footballer of the Year. But that was the game that really got Tyrone moving that year. Then they went on and bet Dublin then in the semi-final, really rocked Dublin. I think Davy Hart might have banged in a goal.
Were you wing forward? Like, were you wing back that day? How bad an experience was it?
No, I was wing forward. I was just poor. I had an awful year in Note 8. I was just one of those years where you just...
In college,
yeah, finished. I was just burning out. I just needed a break from it, and it was just very, very poor. But like Med McMenamin and Gormley an awful lot up in Healy Park in knee games, and they were just sensational. Lads. So we're like, you might score a point or two off them boys, but like they didn't care. Like, you know, they just every ball that came in, you had to work for every single ball, and like confidence never seemed to get the better of them. I even remember Aidan in 0-9 turning Gormley down in McHale Park and burying one, Aidan's first year in, burying one in the bottom corner. Gormley just didn't, like, it just moved on.
They were a brilliant team. They were a brilliant, brilliant team. Defensively, and then, like, say, they're offensive players. Like, O'Neill, Canavan, Mulligan, these some of the best forwards of a generation. They're unbelievable. So,
and I think that's underestimated by that team, Paddy. I think because the way they bet Kerry in North 3, everyone still symbolised.
Yeah, yeah.
But like you go through that team, that team was sensational. You have Brian Dewar at 10. You have Brian McMenamin at 11. Joe
McGuigan.
Yeah, like Joe, or McGuigan at 11.
McGuigan, yeah.
You have Mulligan, O'Neill, Canavan, all there. Probably Sean Kavanagh at 12 because they used to play.
Ryan Mellon.
Yeah, Ryan Mellon, but they used to play Collie Holmes in midfield with the Hub Hughes and them guys. So they used to don't play a mix, and Kavanagh used to come in around with. So they're sensational footballers. Philip Jordan at Philip Jordan.
Philip Jordan, Gourley, Conor Gorman. Like, what a team. And that's, I can see maybe at times when Mickey Hart has been as bonnet about being called defensive and things like that. And you're right, Andy, that Kerry semi-final in 0-3 and Spillane with the nonsense comment that he made, that kind of seemed to stick with that Tyrone team, despite the fact I was on my debut, my first year with Dublin under Pillar was 2008. I was on the bench that day in the quarter final in the rain, and Tyrone were awesome, absolutely awesome, and they went on to win their third All-Ireland that year.
Did it feel like it was the last sting of that Tyrone team in 08? Did it feel
like Dublin, we thought we'd win, which was Dublin back then. And we thought we'd be Kerry the following year, and we didn't do that either. But no, I think a lot of people, it was Tyrone were through the qualifiers. They'd won 3 in 05, and they ended up, they bet Kerry well in the final. Kavanagh was obviously, I think Kavanagh got 5 that day and was player of the year. They were just a magnificent team. And some of those players, and
that was the day of Muggsy's goal, was it?
No, Muggsy was 0-5.
Okay.
Muggsy was 0-5. But if you're looking at Tyrone now, that was Mickey Hart's team. That was his group. This is the evolution. This is the praise we're giving James Horan for turning over the brilliant Mayo team and those brilliant characters, guys like Andy, Keith Higgins, and these guys. It's what Desi is going to have to do with Dublin now to bring them on that transition and try and keep them successful. And that's what Logan and Duhu are trying to do with this Tyrone team. And what they've done to date, as Andy said, has been really successful. Division 1, stayed there. They've won the Ulster Championship. And it's a massive game for them. It's a massive game in the development of what Logan and Duhu are doing and bringing on these guys. And you know, can Darren McCurry, everyone knows he's the talent, can he be the next Owen Mulligan? He's that same sort of profile. You need to do it. Muggsy, a couple of All-Stars, he's 3 All-Irelands.
Yeah.
You know, that's what McCurry is trying to get to. You know, Peter Hart, Matty Donnelly, soldiers. And you've seen, I've no doubt that those guys are looking at Mayo last week and seeing Lee Keegan and Dermot O'Connor, and these guys get their big win, their big statement win, their day in the sun. And Peter Hart and Matty Donnelly, these guys are looking at going, we want that. We want a piece of that. They have a chance on Saturday night to do it. So that's it. Even though there's older guys in that Tyrone team, this is the early stages of the evolution there of what Logan and they were trying to do. And they're trying to emulate that brilliant team of the '90s. And Saturday is a litmus test for them. It'll show them where they're at. They'll get their feedback on Saturday night. And they'll be ready for it. Whether it'll be enough to win the game, I don't think it will. But I definitely think they're going to give Kerry their fill of it.
I think that word is key, evolution as well. And going back to the goal scoring side of things, and when we mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, we mentioned McGuinness in year one with Donegal. They were probably overly defensive. Then the second year, they developed it a tiny bit more, left McFadden up there, McBrearty, Murphy coming off them, yeah. Coming from the back. So they're a tiny bit more in an attacking sense. I think that the four goals in seven games for Tyrone, I think Dougher and Logan and them guys know that that's not enough. And then that can move then into year two, do you know?
Have you been in a team that's been struggling to score goals and you're having conversations about it? How do you fix that? Like,
oh, it's just training ground. But everything is training ground. Like, so if it was Mayo, the Mayo team I was on, like the Conor Loftus ball to Killian at the top of the D, or so, like, you know, you just kind of work on little moves that could work within the game. Like the Lee Keegan goal in 17 isn't too dissimilar to from the Lee Keegan goal in 16.
Mm.
No, like, so we spotted a possible weakness with Dublin, how we got them goals. Now, that was a very hard move to execute both of them.
So what was it? Direct ball from the half forward line to the full forward?
Well, you had to attack Dublin down the centre channel. If you went down the wings at all, you had no chance of getting a goal. You had, like, no chance of getting a goal. So you had to get through the centre channel at some stage for you to have any chance to get in on goal. And Lee just ended up being the fella there twice. But we wanted one of the midfielders and one of the halfbacks to come through that channel. With Tyrone too, it could be just a shift in formation. So it could be just a shift moving 10 yards further up the field, which could make a huge difference.
Yeah.
Put more pressure on a kick out, so that if someone come out and they've only six defenders at that stage, that you're putting more pressure on the opposition kick out, so you can get the ball as well. All little simple changes. Sorry, Paddy.
No, but I just think it's going to be hard for Tyrone, because, like, I absolutely get all that. And I think a key thing to score goals is runners from deep and creating overlaps, which Tyrone have. But on the other side of things, the key thing to get is the personnel.
Yeah.
Like Matty Donnelly's not a goal scorer, and he never has been. He's a brilliant player. Darren McCurry is a better player than I was, but he's similar to me anyway. I wasn't a goal scorer. I love to score points. If McCurry gets a yard, he's going to take a point. Whereas if Conor Callaghan gets a yard, he's with his head down, he's going straight at goal.
Yeah,
Clifford's the same.
So they're missing, like, Ronan O'Neill, is that what we're saying?
Certain players, genuinely, certain players just are goal scorers. You know what I mean? And I don't think, like, Mark Bradley's not a goal scorer either. They're brilliant players in their own way. But, like, we had Dean Rock or Conor Callan, where if there's a sniff of a goal, they're taking it on. Whereas, like, Killian O'Connor's another one. If Killian gets a chance, he's going for goal. Whereas McCurry and Donnelly, they're not. That's just not their game and never has been. That's a tricky one for them. And I agree with Andy. They're probably going to need a couple of goals on Saturday night. And, like I say, I'm sure, like I said, they've had 4 or 5 weeks to prepare for this. They will know that. There's nothing us three Muppets here are talking about that the Tyrone coaches don't realise themselves. Of course they are. They're smart players. So I'm really... We touched on the tactics of the Ulster final. It was the same again as the Connacht final. The Connacht final was tradition. It was energy. Whereas the Ulster final was like a jigsaw, trying to get pieces together. What are Monaghan doing? What are they changing? What are Tyrone doing? Tyrone are going to have a plan for Kerry. What is Kerry's plan to deal with that? What is Peter King going to do? They've kind of steamrolled the Munster Championship. They've strolled through the National League. It's an intriguing game, and I mean, I cannot wait for it. It's kind of been overshadowed a bit by the off the field stuff, and Mayo obviously beating Dublin, but this is going to be a massive, massive game on Saturday night, Crow Park.
Yeah, Moran, you were a goal poacher, weren't you?
Moran scored a load of goals. Yeah,
it was me. I was not. I was my goal scoring took huge thought. Like, I did not score a lot. Like, I think only 11 goals, 12 goals, maybe in the championship. But it took huge thought. Like, it literally took me sitting down, studying, thinking about goals, going to training, putting the ball in the back of the net over and over again. What Paddy is saying, some of these books are just, they're they're different
mentality.
Yeah, and you can see it in soccer. Sure, we love soccer. You can see it like Van Nistelrooy's and these guys. They're real goal scorers. And I think for teams to win All-Irelands and to get close to winning All-Irelands, you need somebody with that mentality in your team. And it's no coincidence that Paddy's mentioned him there. Conor O'Callaghan didn't have his best game last day, but he scores a goal last year in the All-Ireland final. He scored two against us in the 19 semi-final. He scored one against us in 17. He's got that instinct. Clifford has that instinct. You know, there's certain fellas who have that instinct. Like, I think I mentioned it when we were half kind of summarising it, when we thought the game was going to be called off a couple of weeks ago. When Michael Murphy lines up for that goal, for the penalty against Tyrone, Gerard Canning says for his 10th championship goal. And I was like, Michael Murphy sort of scored 9 championship goals. I couldn't believe it. But if you think about that great Donegal team, who was the poacher? Who was the finisher? McFadden. He was the fella who do the jink and roll it into the corner. It was a real instinct. And McFadden had that instinct, lads, when we played against him when he was 16 years of age in the Ted Webb final down in Ballyhomes. Do you know, he was...
But isn't it, Andy, you know the players that have it. And that's what I'm saying. Like, Matty Donnelly's not a goal scorer. No, he's got to go out and score 2 goals on Saturday night. Yeah. but what you're seeing there, they're brilliant point scorers. They're really technical players. And they kick points like you wouldn't believe. Like we've seen so far, McCurdy from everywhere. But it's a different mentality. If you get an inch, I'm going for the goal here. I'm not taking a point. I'm going head down. I'm going at it.
Is it an extra bit of want? Is that what it is? An extra bit of...
Tommy, I'd go for the goal. But yeah. I have the instinct to go for it, but I just don't know you're in a post or do something stupid.
Yeah. Okay, but it is that instinct, Paddy, that kind of split decision to say, if I get this, I'm going for it.
Yeah, but you see it with players. Like Bernard Brogan had it as well. Yeah. It was Gooch had it. Like Gooch, the amount of times Gooch could have just tapped it over the bar for an easy score, but he dummies by another fella. He just sees. It is a mentality, 100%. And it's, in no way is this not a slight on those players. They're brilliant players. But you know it. Andy said it, the soccer players. You know the players who are out-and-out poachers. And that's what I don't think Tyrone. If you look at their full forward, like we think it will be of probably Bradley playing in front, or they might throw the kitchen sink and they might start with McShane inside.
Yeah.
You know, there's not. Well, whereas if Clifford gets the ball, like his goal against Tipperary, like he gets it and he's on an angle and he's on the 21, but he's like, I don't care, but I'm literally drilling this through the goalkeeper into next week.
But I think if we mentioned the player, like O'Mulligan gets the ball on the 45-yard line against Dublin and not 5. Like,
100 dummies and scores a goal.
Like, who in the right mind goes for a goal from there?
Yeah. Well, it was my brother standing in front of him. So we see.
Was Patter the first man to call, or was he the second?
Patter's the first. I think Paul Casey's the second. So Paul Casey, whatever about Patter missed the first one. Hell, you missed the second one.
Yeah, but he literally. And I think Paddy's point is just it's an instinct of I see a goal here, let's go for it. And it's a lovely mentality to have. And to have someone in your team that's like that is a godsend for players like me and Paddy because.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
We naturally didn't have that because we played in the backs and we played wing back and grew up. We were just different players.
Compliments. That's the like a forward line of compliments. He's going to do this. I'm really good at this. He's really good at that. That guy's really good at that. That's the balance we're talking about. It'll be interesting to watch on Saturday night because I agree, but I think they're going to need it. They're going to need to get scores on the board because Kerry are going to rack up a score even if Tyrone play defensively. Kerry, 22 goals?
Yeah, it's outrageous. It's outrageous.
Phenomenal. Yeah.
Yeah, really, really good stuff there, as always, from Paddy Andrews and Andy Moran with Tommy Rooney on the Paddy and Andy pod. And available to listen on all the usual platforms. That is episode 16 right now. That's, of course, if you didn't get it on the OTB Sports app on Tuesday, where it's available exclusively first every single week. You can download the OTB Sports app if you haven't already. In the App Store or the Play Store. This week is a Tyrone Kerry special, so make sure you get it before Saturday evening. That throw in at Croke Park, of course. And Mike Quirk will be alongside us for that game at Croke Park. He'll be on updates across the afternoon, and it'll be Saturday with John Duggan. So we'll keep you right on top of that game on Off the Ball on Saturday afternoon. All right, we're turning to Premier League now. We're delighted to welcome Gareth Roberts of the Anfield Wrap back to the show this morning. Gareth, good morning.
Good morning.
Keeping well, Gareth. We're going to get into Liverpool and Chelsea this weekend very shortly. I just wanted to kind of maybe take a quick look back first on last weekend and the Burnley game. And I guess a lot of the fallout from this match has been centering around Jurgen Klopp's post-match comments about some of the hard tackling, I guess, from the Burnley players. Like, Burnley didn't get a single yellow card in the game, and yet Jurgen Klopp was quite angry afterwards. So what did you make of the whole reaction to Klopp's comments?
Yeah, I thought the reaction was a bit strange, to be honest. It felt as though from the moment he'd said it to now, really, that a lot of people have grabbed it as a narrative that he's looking to gain an advantage in future games. And I don't think that's the case for a minute. I mean, you know, we're playing Chelsea at the weekend, and Chelsea are not an over-physical side, I wouldn't say. So I don't think he's trying to get in the referee's head for this weekend. Also, if Burnley sort of toned down their approach, well, that's not Liverpool's advantage, is it? Because Liverpool have already played them. I think he was genuinely commenting on some of the challenges in the game. And some of the challenges for me when I was in the ground, I thought, were over the top. And I was very surprised not to see the normally card-happy Mike Dean, you know, brandish a few cards, to be honest. You know, they were hard. I think everyone's got a bit mixed up in sort of, you know, letting games flow and there being hard challenges, which I'm all up for. I love it. I love watching Graham Souness back in his day for Liverpool. I love watching Steven Gerrard in his day for Liverpool. Both loved a hard challenge. But, you know, there's still got to be a line there, and I felt some of Burnley's challenges did cross that line. I mean, you know, there were challenges there where the ball wasn't involved, if you look at the one on Matip. Obviously, Jota's wrestled to the ground. That's been widely shared on social media since. And I just think some of the pundits sort of sought out a line and then rigidly stuck to it and didn't want to say, well, actually, you know, we've looked at it again and maybe Klopp's got a point. And then it sort of got mashed in with what Solskjaer said after Manchester United's game as well. And then it just became a bit of a thing of, OK, well, let's have a go at the big managers and let's maybe ignore the point that they're making. Because, as I say, I think one or two of Burnley's challenges did cross the line across the 90 minutes.
Is there maybe a case that, I guess, some of the big clubs, certainly the top four, five, six clubs in the Premier League, especially when they're at home and especially when they have the home crowd with them, They're so used to getting decisions, I guess, their way. Yeah. Maybe sometimes 50-50 decisions up their way. So for Klopp, it was probably a bit surprising that it was kind of almost tilted the other way at the weekend.
Yeah, I would say that's a fair point. Obviously, if you look back in history, you know, the likes of Liverpool, Manchester United, you know, have got one or two penalties at home, it's fair to say. Although Liverpool did seem to go through a phase where that turned on its head and almost felt like referees didn't want to give it for exactly the reason you're saying, almost like they came to Anfield going, OK, well, I don't want to show that I'm a soft touch. I can't comment on other clubs and how that felt for them because I don't follow them home and away like I do Liverpool, but it certainly felt like that for a while. So, maybe there was a little bit of that. I just think, you know, they've obviously had these meetings. The referees have taken a certain, you know, road and decided that they want to let things flow. And that's absolutely fine. As I say, the Euros was fantastic, wasn't it? I'm sure everyone would agree in how that was refereed. And, you know, to let a bit of that in the Premier League, you know, superb, because last season was grim. Everything was pulled up. There was too much use of VAR. It all slowed down. It all got a bit choppy. So I get that they want to let it flow. I just think some of the challenges on Saturday, you know, most people in football, if they took the specs off, you know, and looked at it again, would say, yeah, that one's a foul. That one's a foul. That should have been a booking. You know, as you said there, you know, Mike Dean didn't book a single person. And this isn't to have a go at Burnley either. I think by the end of the game that Burnley were knackered because he'd had to run around off Liverpool. So some of their players, I don't think it was, you know, I don't think they're intending to do the player, if you like. I think they're just tired, and they were tired challenges. But some of those tired challenges were bordering on dangerous. There was one on Harvey Elliott towards the end, which, you know, he sort of leapt out the way of a little bit and was fine. But, you know, on another day, he'd be currently, you know, on the treatment table. So I think the points from Klopp were fine at the end of the day, but, you know, they got twisted, they got turned into a story. And as I say, it felt as though some pundits wanted to double down on it. You know, Jermaine Genas, I think, has gone three times on it now, you know, Match of the Day, Radio 5 and on Twitter. And it's and you know, people are sending him the clips of the over the top challenges, and his reply is a crying emoji. And it's a bit like, well, you're working at the top level of punditry, mate. You know, why don't you engage with supporters who've actually got a fair point here?
And some of the criticism, I guess, from a devil's advocate point of view, levelled towards Klopp was that he named players, that perhaps it's unusual for a manager to I guess name players. I think Ashley Barnes was named, maybe Chris Wood as well, if I'm not mistaken, by Jurgen Klopp, like that, as opposed to, you know, just saying Burnley got decisions today, Burnley were over the top of the tackling. Like, what did you make of the fact that he kind of pinpointed a couple of players, or is that even an issue in your view?
I think maybe Sean Dyche had a point on that, because I don't think it is normal to name players like that. I think you're right in that normally you would go more blanket and you would say Burnley's approach today, you know, and that kind of line. So maybe it was, you know, maybe Klopp was a touch too emotional there and shouldn't have named names. And, you know, that does feel slightly unfair in terms of, you know, we talk about getting into officials' heads, don't we? So, you know, will now officials be watching those particular players a little bit more? So, yeah, I can see why, you know, Burnley fans, Sean Dyche, people who don't like Liverpool, I can see why they would look at that particular aspect of it and say, yeah, Jurgen Klopp was a bit out of order there.
Before I get back to the on-pitch matters ahead of the Chelsea game, Gareth, like, just to touch on the the homophobic chanting from the game with Norwich and directed towards Billy Gilmore, and I know it was dealt with very well, I actually thought, by the club and by Klopp, sitting down and having an open conversation with member of the supporters group from the LGBTQ plus community. And I guess in some ways the response of the club to those chants was encouraging. Unfortunately, it's something we see in football all the time. There are offensive chants, there are racist chants, there are homophobic chants. But the reaction of the club was quite encouraging, I thought.
Yeah, it was. You know, it went to the very top, didn't it? In that, you know, Jurgen Klopp had to sit down with cop-outs who represent, you know, the LGBT community who support Liverpool. So, you know, that was fantastic. We've done work with them ourselves at the Anfield Wrap. And I think for me, it's very, very simple. If there are a section of our supporters who are saying that they find this chant offensive, then let's just leave it. Let's leave it. And it's as simple as that. You know, there's lots of whataboutry. There's lots of it doesn't mean this, it means this. But like I say, if people from that community are literally saying, I find this offensive, this makes me uncomfortable, well, I don't like the idea of that personally. I think, you know, when you're stood on the cop, the whole idea of it is that you feel as one, that you feel together, you know, and that you're getting behind your team as a collective. And if there's people within that number who feel uncomfortable by something that's going on, then let's just nip it in the bud. You know, people going back sort of 30 and 40 years to explain a chant, and it's because of this and it's because of that. I mean, wow. Like, it's really simple for me, as I say. You know, if people are feeling uncomfortable at a game, let's not make them feel uncomfortable. It's really as simple as that. As you say, there are loads of chants, you know, that are in repertoires of clubs across the country that are a little bit grim and we need to move on. You know, I've been on here before and talked about, you know, references of Hillsborough, Heysel, you know, and all the rest of it. You know, we just the Munich air disaster as well and things like that. You know, can't we all just be a little bit better than this? We've all been through a little bit of a grim time. Obviously, it's been an unprecedentedly weird time. And when you emerge the other side of it, you kind of think, or I think, well, can't we all try and be a little bit better now? And look, that's maybe naive, because I think maybe there's an edge of supporters across the land who will always take things too far. But, you know, you would like to think that communication like Liverpool did does start to change some minds. And yet you're right in that, you know, Liverpool were out there early, got the manager involved, and I think that was an excellent way to deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Hear, hear. Some good news on the pitch for Liverpool this week with Andy Robertson. Robertson signing his contract extension until 2026. I know he'd only signed a previous contract in 2019, but with Kostas Tsimikas doing what he's doing at the moment, Gareth, in that left-back position, and I think he only had maybe 6 minutes of Premier League action last year with Robertson, of course, keeping him out of the team. But, I mean, you can't really take Tsimikas out of the team at the moment, can you?
I don't know, you know, I've been thinking about this one all week, and, you know, Tsimikas has played really well. You know, he had a moment there against Burnley where he was battling away for the ball with a few Burnley players and then sort of emerged with it, and the ground absolutely loved that one, and everyone was up on the feet, you know, applauded him. And it felt like a bit of an Andy Robertson moment, in that it just sort of summed up the lad's spirit, because you're quite right to say that, you know, last season we were all looking at it saying, well, is this lad any good? Because, you know, we were going through a defensive crisis, and at times Robertson looked shot. It looked like he was chugging. You know, he played every single Premier League game last season, And you were like, well, when does he get a rest? And why is this lad so far off? And there was even rumours he might go in the summer. And, you know, when you saw what had come the season before, you thought, well, look, maybe in training he's just not at the level that Liverpool want. But he's coming to the team, played really well. And like I said, he seems very likeable as a character as well, which I think is important because, you know, when the crowd take to you, it helps. So what I would say is that whoever starts at left back at the weekend, I don't think there's going to be many moans about it. But I've got a sneaking suspicion it might be Robertson because I think to put him on the bench last weekend, sort of ahead of schedule, you know, that was a bit of a sort of, that was Klopp saying, well, where he's at. You know, if he's happy to be on the bench, then, you know, he's happy to play him, I would say, because otherwise, why put him there? So I just think he's got the edge, Robertson, in that he's got all this time under his belt playing next to Virgil van Dijk and the rest of the defence. He understands exactly what Klopp wants going forward and going back. I think he's got the edge over Tsimikas defensively as well. But look, if the sports scientists behind the scenes, listen, Robertson's not ready for 90 and certainly not at the energy levels that he'll need against Chelsea, stick with Tsimikas. Like I said, I don't think anyone will be complaining about that because Tsimikas has done really well this season so far.
Yeah, it's going to be a cracking game. So it's Liverpool-Chelsea at Anfield, 5:30 on Saturday evening. Liverpool have lost just two of their last 13 Premier League games against Chelsea. Of course, though, one of those defeats came in the most recent game back in March. But it's kind of delicately poised, this one. And I guess one of the interesting strands heading into this one, Gareth, is the Klopp-Tuchel battle. And I think maybe Klopp is the manager Tuchel has faced most often in his career, of course, from their backgrounds in the Bundesliga. But this pair could become a real rivalry in the Premier League in terms of managers.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, Liverpool and Chelsea have got a bit of a nouveau rivalry as well. I mean, I've written and talked a lot about how I don't really regard it as one because, you know, I've supported Liverpool so long that for me, everything revolves around Everton and Manchester United. They're Liverpool's rivals, if you like. But Liverpool played Chelsea so many times when we were under Rafa Benitez that it did develop into a rivalry. And you can sort of see that happening again because, you know, both clubs have got brilliant managers. Both clubs have got brilliant teams. And it's not beyond the realms to say that they could be facing off basically for all the major competitions over the coming years. So you can see it developing into a rivalry, you're quite right. And I think this game's fantastic. You know, a few people are saying it's coming a bit early in the season and does that take something off it? No, you know, not at all for me. I think footy's changed now in that, you know, once upon a time we had all the cliches, didn't we, about it's a marathon, not a sprint, and you could have a little bit of a slow start. But look, it took Liverpool 99 points to win the Premier League finally. They didn't win it with 97. I think Liverpool have very much learned the lesson now that, you know, it's not a marathon. It's 38 sprints. You've got to come absolutely out the blocks from day one and you've got to win your games and you've got to have no regrets. So I think they'll be going into Chelsea fully looking to win it. Equally, Chelsea will be the same the other way. Tuchel's done a fantastic job since he's come in there. You've got to take your hat off to him. Obviously, won two trophies already. I think it's only three defeats in the Premier League and sort of two of them were, you know, when they had their eyes on the prize in terms of the Champions League as well. So it's going to be a very difficult match for Liverpool, but a very difficult match for Chelsea as well. And I think it really is one of them where you can see it going either way. What I'm looking forward to is, I'm a supporter. I will be in the centre of the cop and I can't wait to see what Anfield's like, 5:30 full for a game like Liverpool-Chelsea. I mean, we had a bit of a warm-up with the Burnley game, but, you know, that was an early kick-off. People are still a little bit sleepy at 12:30, I think. You know, it's hard to sort of really get up for those games. But 5:30 on a Saturday is a perfect time for a football match. And what a football match Liverpool-Chelsea will be.
Yeah, there'll be a few more pints had in by 5:30 compared to 12:30, I think. Yeah, absolutely. No doubt. Like, we spoke about Andy Robertson there, and maybe towards the other end of the spectrum, one of the younger players, Harvey Elliott, someone, it's hardly new to call him an exciting prospect in Liverpool because everyone knows exactly what he's capable of at this stage. But, I mean, when you look at the players that have signed contracts with Liverpool in the last few years, aside from Robertson, like, you've got Alisson, Fabinho, Van Dijk, Trent, all signing contracts and adding to the experience. But, you know, how exciting is it for Liverpool fans to see someone like Harvey Elliott come up through the ranks and do what he's doing at the moment?
Yeah, really exciting. I mean, I think the Harvey Elliott story is a really intriguing one already, in that, you know, I think it sort of got lost a little bit in the story that Real Madrid were in for him, you know, that so high did they rate his talent and they tried to get him. And, you know, I think he met Real Madrid with his dad, but, you know, opted for Liverpool because they are Liverpool fans. His family's are Liverpool fans. They've been to Liverpool games even when he was at Fulham. So, you know, Liverpool got that edge there and managed to get him signed up. And I think the tribunal fee in the end is £4 million or so. You know, that's going to look like an absolute snip because the lad has absolutely got it. You know, he makes his debut for Fulham while he's still at school. He goes out on loan to Blackburn, and I think he's player of the season there. He's picking up awards. And, you know, I was always keeping an eye on him because, you know, the little bits that we got to see him in a Liverpool shirt before he went on loan, he really excited me then. I just think he's got great vision. He's got a great touch. You know, he's way beyond his years in sort of how he reads the game and his intelligence around football. You know, conversely, there was an interview that went out with him this week and has done the rounds on social media. And on that, he's a very shy boy. And it's sort of, you know, it's mad to watch that. That's a reminder that he is 18 years old. But when you're watching him on the football pitch, he doesn't look 18 years old there. He looks like he can more than handle himself. He can thread a great through ball. He's got a great first touch on him. He's going to score spectacular goals as well. He had a go at one in one of the friendlies that hit the bar. And if it went in, even though it was a friendly, I think it would have taken the roof off. The audacity of it to even try it was brilliant. So, yeah, we are all really excited about watching him because you always are, aren't you? When someone comes through that age with that ability, you're thinking, well, it's going to be fantastic watching his journey and watching him right now. But also, where can he go? Where will he end up in terms of how good will he be in the future? Because, you know, he's... fingers crossed, he's got sort of, you know, the best chunk of 20 years ahead of him. So, you know, what can he achieve in the game and that kind of thing? So it is really exciting. It was a promising debut. I mentioned before that, you know, one or two of the challenges from Burnley were quite tasty on Elliot as well. You know, they were getting stuck into him. And I think he touched the ball more than anyone else in the Liverpool side on Saturday, I think I'm right in saying. And what was telling for me is not only what he did with the ball and his involvement in that brilliant second Liverpool goal, but also the fact that his teammates were willing to give him the ball. Often you see a young lad come into the first team and, you know, teammates might look, see that it's the young lad making his debut and say, okay, well, I don't want to give him the ball. I don't want to put too much pressure on him. I'll opt for the safer option. But everyone was giving Harvey the ball, which said to me, they've seen him in training, they know the level he's at, and they're more than happy to trust him to go and take Liverpool forward in the game.
Gareth, great stuff. I can't wait for the Romelu Lukaku, Virgil van Dijk battle as well. There's a bit of Belgium-Dutch needle there, undoubtedly, as well. But listen, enjoy the game on Saturday in the Cup.
Thanks very much, mate.
Thanks a million. Gareth Roberts there, founder of the Anfield Wrap, of course. Great stuff from him as always. You can listen back to that, of course, on the podcast, or you can get it on youtube.com/offtheball if you missed any of it. OTB Sports, I just want to bring you this in association with Cadbury FC and their club partnerships are returning for another series of in-depth chats with some of the biggest names in Premier League and Irish football history. With access to all areas, we chat to some of the legendary names from the big clubs and meet the crucial people behind the scenes who make a Premier League club what it is. First up, Champions League and Premier League winners Roberto Di Matteo and Karen Carney will join us for our Access All Areas Chelsea special, along with coach Lisa Fallon. That's coming to OTB Sports social channels very soon, so keep an eye out for that. Just want to bring you up to speed with what we've got on OTB Sports Radio today. From 1 o'clock, it's OTB Gold with Cora Staunton. From 3 p.m. then, you'll get the History of Sport. 4 p.m, it's a retro panel on Limerick's 2018 All-Ireland hurling title triumph. From 6 p.m, OTB Gold, Brian O'Driscoll meeting Issa Nathewa. From 7 p.m. then, of course, live on air, as per usual, Off the Ball tonight as well. And just to mention what's coming up on Off the Ball across this weekend, 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock, we're live on air on Saturday. John Duggan in the hot seat, of course. We've got a Paralympics special Saturday panel. John Fulham and Orla Barry will be among our guests on that. And then, of course, OTB Football Saturday. Plenty to talk into. Chelsea-Liverpool, we mentioned, at Anfield, getting underway at 5:30. Plenty more preview of that one and reaction, of course, to Man City and Arsenal in the early kickoff as well in the Premier League. Mikel Arteta, no doubt under a bit of pressure, especially if Arsenal were to go on and lose that game. It would be a terrible start to their season if that were to happen. We'll also, of course, have updates from Mike Quirk at Kerry Tyrone in the All-Ireland Senior Football Championship semi-final across the day on Saturday at Croke Park. And then on Sunday, Joe is live in the hot seat from 1 to 7 We'll, of course, have live Premier League commentary. Two live games for you to bring you. Tottenham against Wolves. Tottenham against Watford, this weekend. Brian Kerr will be alongside Dave McIntyre for that game at 2 o'clock. And then from 4:30, it's Wolves against Manchester United. That game will be watched by Kenny Cunningham and Stephen Doyle. We'll also have updates from the All-Ireland Senior Camogie semi-final doubleheader at Croke Park. Sarah O'Donovan will be there for us. And we'll have, of course, the paper review as well to bring you Gavin Comiskey and Conor McKeown on that one. Right, we'll hear from Alison Rudd a little later this morning. There's TV, of course, with Sue Murphy as well and Joseph Conroy. And up next this morning on OTB AM, Phil joins us to bring you the latest from the Paralympics in Tokyo.
OTB AM.
Yeah, it's 9:07 on this Thursday morning here on OTB AM. Shane with you right through until 10 o'clock this morning. Now, the Paralympics is, of course, in full flow. We've got our Paralympics report this morning and every morning on OTB AM from around 9 a.m. with Phil Egan. It's all with thanks to Toyota Ireland. Hashtag start your impossible. Phil, what is happening in Tokyo?
Yeah, thanks, Shane. Another busy day for Team Ireland at the Paralympics and a very good chance of a medal later this morning, a first Irish medal at these games. And Ellen Keane will swim in the final of the SB8 100 metres breaststroke after setting a personal best winner heat. Clocked the time of 1 minute 21.71 seconds. And the 26-year-old Dubliner won bronze in this event in Rio 5 years ago. So she's competing at her fourth Paralympics. Plenty of experience. Back in the pool for that final at around 20 to 12 this morning, Irish time. Now, after reaching the final of the 100 metres butterfly yesterday, Roisin Nareen's qualified for another final. This is her first Paralympics. The 16-year-old from Limerick finished third this morning in her heat of the S13 100 metres breaststroke. Nareen set a new PB, a time of 1 minute 9.23 seconds. She'll swim in the final at around 11:15. And just to show you the standard in that race, Gia Pergolini from the USA set a new world record in the heats, finishing in a time of 1 minute 5.05 seconds. Rio gold medal winning cyclists Katie George Dunleavy and Eve McChrystal finished sixth in the B1000 metres time trial. The duo set a new Irish record on personal best, finishing in a time of 1 minute 9.044 seconds. The Netherlands won gold in that race. Galway's Ronan Grimes also produced his best ever performance in the C4 1000 metres time trial final, with a ride of 1 minute 8.62 seconds. Grimes shaved over a second off his personal best in the event. He finished 15th overall. Gold on that one went to Spain. Colin Judge received a walkover in his scheduled Class 3 table tennis singles match. He is back in action tomorrow. Still more Irish athletes to come. Obviously, I mentioned the two swimmers, but Rosemary Gaffney and Tasman Addison in the equestrian. 62-year-old Gaffney from Clonmel has had to wait a long time for her chance to compete at the Paralympics. She was Ireland's reserve for London 2012 and Rio 2016, but she's just about to go in the Grade 4 individual test on board Werona. And Tasman Addison goes in the Grade 5 individual test, and that is after 12 o'clock. A reminder, you're listening to our Paralympic report on OTB AM, coming your way every morning at 9 o'clock. And it's all with thanks to Toyota Ireland. Hashtag start your impossible.
Yeah, it's 11 minutes past 9 on this Thursday morning here on OTB AM. Shane with you right through until 10 a.m. this morning. OTB AM brought to you by Gillette. Good mornings start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Right, it is time for TV talk. Time to say a very good morning to Sue Murphy and Joseph Conroy. Morning, guys.
Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
How are you?
Keeping well, keeping well. I know you guys kind of were infatuated with Malas at the Palace, I think, last week, was it? And I was one of those people as well. But Sue, this Untold series is appearing quite regularly in your What's New and Shiny, and rightly so.
I don't know when people are going to stop listening to me talking about this, because I talk about it all the time. And I mean, like, going around the house talking about it all day. Did you know about, like, it's just, I love that they're telling these stories in a new way. And I was saying yesterday, like, Caitlyn Jenner's story, that's the newest one that's gone out, the Caitlyn Jenner, Bruce Jenner's decathlon in 1976 in Montreal when he broke a world record. I knew everything about Bruce Jenner from Keeping Up with the Kardashians. I'm slightly ashamed of that, but that's the person that I knew. I knew he was Olympian and I knew he was famous, but I didn't really know the story. And his story about, like, how he tried to cover up who he was at the time by just playing tons and tons of sport. Every kind of sport that he could play, he played it. And everything he could train at, he trained it. And became obsessed with winning, not winning the gold medal, but beating this guy from the USSR called Yuvalov, I think his name was. And he was just obsessed with beating him. And that consumed, like, even when Caitlin is telling the story now. So she's saying, you know, it was Bruce. Bruce won these medals and he became obsessed with beating this guy. And the whole narrative is, I have to beat this guy. He won a medal last year. And it feels like it's not even about the medal. So it's just, it's really like tension filled, really, a really good, like, deep dive into an Olympian story. I know we hear those stories a lot, but there's something different about him at the time and why he was so consumed by it. And it's actually really interesting. But the other one is the Christy Martin doc, which I'm sure you probably have seen. So good. The first, first kind of big female boxer, and her home life, where she was eventually stabbed 8 times by her husband and then shot in the stomach, and was like, he's not going to kill me. No one's going to kill me. And it was just like so consumed with how amazing this woman is and what she's achieved in her life. And they're just brilliant docs. They're so slick. They look really good. I think even for people that know those stories, they're giving them a little bit of extra information, but they're also drawing people in. And like, I'm obsessed with Malice at the Palace. I just thought I would actually go back and watch that again. And I don't really watch docs again. I just thought it was really, really good.
Oh, like, I have to hold my hands up. I wasn't actually familiar with the whole Pistons Pacers brawl at all. Like, it was just a piece of NBA history that had completely skipped me by. And like, I fell in love with, like, I was talking earlier about falling in love with Daniel Ricciardo on the Netflix Drive to Survive. I fell in love with Steven Jackson on this.
He's great.
Malice at the Palace. I mean, just the character in it. Like, Joe, are you along similar lines? Have you been following this whole Untold series?
Yeah, absolutely. I've gone down the Malice at the Palace rabbit hole. I'd be similar to yourself. To me, it would have been just kind of like a viral YouTube clip that kind of pops up every now and then in sort of whoever's conversation about brawls, or especially brawls that kind of spill into the crowd, and that whole sort of really kind of murky world you just never really want to see happen. But I thought it was incredible. I've been kind of, there's a little sort of cottage industry now of sort of the fallout from the documentary. So if you kind of go on YouTube, there's all these great deep dives with sort of all the players kind of giving their sort of little extra bits that aren't in the documentary, or even just kind of general sort of basketball podcasts and shows kind of giving their own takes on it and revisiting it. But yeah, I thought it was incredible. Great stuff. That whole series has been incredible. Like a quick one as well, just during my Saturday evening thrall through random Malice in the Palace fallout clips on YouTube, I was served up as like an autoplay this piece from ABC in Australia. It's called Luke Longley, The Missing Chapter of The Last Dance. And just to kind of set the context, I was sitting there sort of, you know, kind of wrapping up this sort of Malice in the Palace watch. And then this came on and I was going to go make dinner, but I was like, oh, this looks kind of interesting. Kind of got through the intro and just myself and my girlfriend ended up sitting there for an hour just watching this documentary. It's brilliant. Basically, for a bit of context, he's a 7'2" Australian basketball player who was on the kind of 90s Bulls team, sort of joined was traded to the Bulls during the Jordan's playing basketball baseball season. And it's just really interesting. One thing that strikes you really early is the caliber of people involved with it. You've got like Pippen, Kerr, Jackson, even Michael Jordan in it. And you're kind of like, Jesus, someone's done a really good job on research or booking here. But kind of as it goes on, you kind of realize he's kind of been written out of history a little bit. And one of the highlights to kind of, it's come for the story, but one of the highlights is you've got Michael Jordan there. He's kind of done his flex of sort of being the producer on his own documentary about his own incredible legacy. Sitting there, he's completely written this guy out of the story, not going to mention, would have been one of the starting five on the court for all the big games, completely edited out. So you kind of realize halfway through, he's sort of sitting there partially to sort of tell his story, also partially because he's edited this guy out of his own documentary, and also as kind of the extension of the flex of being the producer of his own documentary, he's now like editorially standing over his work, which is commendable. But it's really nice. It kind of, it's a really good human story. There's kind of almost a bit of a, you could imagine if it was an Irish person who'd been on the Bulls team and being written out. So kind of got this slightly parochial Australian take on the whole story while he's telling his own personal story. So just as a heads up, if you're looking for more good basketball documentary content after you've watched All the Untells, it's one to look out for. That's called Luke Longley, The Missing Chapter of The Last Dance.
Brilliant. Yeah, that'll keep us going. Where can people watch that one, Joe? Is that on... That's not on Netflix.
No, it's on YouTube. So it was just uploaded by ABC Australia, the TV station over there who did it. So that's up on YouTube, free to watch. It's kind of clocked up about 500,000 views in a week. So it seems to be working its way into other people's algorithms and kind of having a good kind of second life there on YouTube.
Yeah, those, like, all of these things send you down dark rabbit holes. Any show that sends you down a rabbit hole, like, is going to be a good show. Like you mentioned, Sue, like the Untold stuff is just brilliant. The Christy Martin's story is just harrowing in some parts, but also what she's done. Like, we talk about Katie Taylor and Kelly Harrington quite a lot in this show, and what she did as a trailblazer for women's boxing. Christy Martin is just incomparable as well, to be fair. Anything else new and shiny, Sue, that's caught your eye as well?
The other thing that I'm absolutely obsessed with is the McCartney documentary that's gone on to Disney. So it went on yesterday. It's McCartney 321 and it's him with Rick Rubin. And this is just, they've just looked at music documentaries and gone, no, we're not going to do it like that. We're going to rip it all up and start again. And they've taken several Beatles tracks, some Wings tracks, and tried to work out how they got to the point where they recorded each of them in the studio. So they've pulled in, like, all the things are on the desk. They're pulling out the drums, they're taking out the guitars, they're putting up the vocals. And Paul is talking through, you know, I Michel Mabel, like, I knew someone who was a French teacher and I asked her what rhymed with Michelle and she said Mabel, and I was like, oh, that sounds great. And then he's talking about, like, how much he loves Edith Piaf, and he's just, it's unbelievable his ability to take in everything around him. Like, he goes to a gig, he sees this guy once and he's like, I'll never forget that riff. And he turns around and starts playing the piano. And what's beautiful about this documentary is they've just let him at it. They've just given him a desk and they've allowed him to just talk about his music and the music that he likes in a really kind of open way. And Ruben is actually really good the way he's directing it, because every couple of minutes he'll just, like, put up a fader and he'll be like, what do you think of this? And then they go off on another tangent and it goes all over the place. Like, there's no structure to this. Don't expect any structure. But it really works for it. And I did sound engineering in college and I'm just absolutely obsessed with how they make tracks and where they put in drums. And if they take in somebody and they're like, hey, you play this musical instrument you've never played before, or I need an intro to this, and George Harrison's just like, grand, I'll just play an intro. Like, it's their music ability as a band and his musical ability and his ability to listen to music and know exactly what he needs to play is unbelievable. And I think there'd be something, there's some of the stories I kind of heard before because I'm a massive Beatles fan, but the way he's telling them, he's just so excited. Like, it's so amazing to see someone like McCartney, who you think would be really tired by the music industry at this stage, so excited by music. And it's just wonderful. I've watched 3 episodes now. I watched another 2 last night back to back. And I was like, will I stay up and watch 6? But it's just, like, honestly, if you're into, you don't even have to be into the Beatles. I really would say that. Like, I think it's just, if you're into music and music production, and how they get to a point where they make amazing albums like Sgt. Pepper's, then it's definitely one to watch. It's so, so good.
Yeah, some of these music docs, like, are just amazing. Like, Supersonic is an obvious one that a lot of people have seen with Oasis. But yeah. Even the Johnny Cash's Lost Tour of Ireland, I think it was called, and it was on RTÉ at one point.
I saw that on RTÉ a couple of weeks ago, yeah.
Really, really good. Like, they never knew about it. It's just madness. Some of these stories that you hear are just crazy, but some really, really good stuff there. In terms of other stuff, like, I know over the last month or so, I had a lot of time while I had COVID to kind of sit down and watch different movies, and Us from Jordan Peele was one of them that I just hadn't watched when it was out in the theaters at the time. But Jordan, every single piece Jordan Peele does is excellent, and there's a new piece out as well.
Yeah, we've got Candyman arriving this week. And like you said, Us. Did you know much about Us before you watched it, Shane?
I knew nothing about Us. I had seen Get Out, so I was kind of expecting similar eerie kind of vibes. And I mean, spoiler alert, but I'm sure a lot of people have seen it by this point. But when the family come into the house, and it's the exact same family, but way worse and creepier. I nearly lost the plot. I was terrified. Like, I'm not gonna, maybe it was the COVID that just had me nice and sensitive, but
terrifying.
It freaked me out. Like, is Candyman supposed to be along similar lines, or what's the deal?
Yeah, it's good. That's kind of, if anyone hasn't watched it, that's only kind of, it's a mini spoiler. So I'd definitely check that out. I just think what's amazing is kind of, it's always, he has this mix of sort of incredible kind of unsettlingness and kind of classic kind of horror chops with sort of a bit of kind of dark comedy thrown in and a bit of kind of, obviously a lot of social commentary as well. So
it's social commentary, definitely, yeah.
Exactly. So what I'm thinking is interesting about this is he's taking, I haven't seen the original from the 90s. I believe you have, Sue, but we're in the kind of terrifying. Same cinematic universe. So it's not a remake. It's not a sequel. It's kind of a sequel, but it's like just same IP, same universe, but bringing it up to date. What I think is interesting is something like Candyman is like such a classic kind of horror, kind of urban legend kind of story. I'm really excited to see what he does with kind of such a conventional jumping off point. Sprinkling his own magic on it. So I know it's been really well received. That's out this week, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Can I tell you my Candyman story? I was in college a long time ago. We won't talk about when it was. But I watched Candyman with one of my friends, Stephen Nolan, who decided that after Candyman, he would go into the bathroom and say Candyman 5 times in the mirror and run out the front door. And I was sitting in the sitting room for the entire, I wouldn't go to bed. I would go to the bathroom. I was like sitting there for the entire night going, no. So I will not be watching this film. It absolutely, and to be honest, Get Out has stayed with me since It was terrifying. The bit where he's in the basement, I was like, no, I can't deal with this, because it is, it's unsettling. That's exactly the word for it. It's not even just full on horror. It's just like, could that happen? That is not, no, it's, yeah, he's really good at it.
Yeah, I think that is the perfect word to sum up Jordan Peele's work. Like, you just feel terrified and unsettled after it. It was just ridiculous. I'll be watching Candyman, but I'll be watching behind a pillow, no doubt. Some might have missed stuff. You're kind of going back to the music theme here with your might have missed a Metallica documentary, Sue, of all things.
Have you seen this, Shane?
I haven't seen this. I have no idea what this is.
I feel like you would have seen it. I know Joe has seen it, and we're both slightly obsessed with it as well. This, like, I remember seeing this in college. So when we were doing sound engineering, Metallica's Black Album was one of the albums we had to study. And purely for guitars alone, like, it's just such an amazing album. But we had to watch Some Kind of Monster, and it was kind of just to get an insight into the band and what they were like. And I was expecting, like, full-on parties, drugs everywhere, women, like, madness. And we were, like, a good few minutes into it, so kind of the bass player leaves, James Winstead, and he's like, I'm done with the band. And they decide to go through group therapy and find out about all this anger and aggression that they've had all the years and where it comes from. And you're like, well, it's probably been fueling all of the amazing work that you've been doing. But it's unbelievable. Like, if you think Metallica is sitting in a room and they're being told to kind of hug each other and kind of get over this scenario, you're like, what am I watching? Because it's like, it doesn't match with the public image that you have of Metallica as a heavy metal band. And then all of this kind of, like, looking into themselves and deep diving into their past, and you're like, what? This just, it is an incredible documentary. It's just like, you watch it and you're like, I can't believe they let this go out, because they're so, in some of the scenes, they're so honest about what's happened within the band and stuff that's happened to them in their own past. And it's just, you get to the end and you're like, I never thought it would be at the end when I started watching this documentary, where I would be now and what I've learned about Metallica. And it's honestly brilliant. And I don't think some of these music documentaries are so contrived now, what they want you to see about the band. This was really like, it was warts and all, kind of like, what the hell is going on here? It is exceptional. It's on Netflix. It's so, so good. I know Joe is a mad fan of it as well.
I'm kind of curious, did the sound engineering lecturer kind of wheel in the VHS player and go, now here's how you make an album? Or
he was like, this is how they made an album.
Yeah,
like, it's mad. Like, I remember telling people afterwards that I studied Metallica, and they were like, you studied Metallica? And I was like, they're amazing. They're geniuses. Like, they are.
I kind of came to it from a bit of a similar starting off point. I would have been, like, massively immersed in guitar at the time, learning guitar. And Kirk Hammett would have been one of my favorite guitarists, still is, like, absolutely incredible musician, the lead guitarist for Metallica. So I was there. I actually saw this with a friend of mine we used to play music with. We rocked up. It was like limited release in 2004 in the IFI. Very one of the kind of small rooms. Walk in. Nice kind of Sunday afternoon. Loads of Metallica fans there. Start playing the film. And it's like 5 or 10 minutes in, you're kind of like, what? It kind of came with very little context. It's like, what the hell is going on here? And then once it gets going, it's just like, it's absolutely hilarious. It's incredible. It's unbelievable that it exists. One, that it was made. Two, that it was put out. Three, it was put out. How it was put out. making them look as like stupid as they look. But they're so, especially kind of James Hetfield and Lars Ulrich, the two kind of competing band leaders, they're so earnest and so invested in what they're doing. You're just kind of wondering, what's their analysis of this film? What eyes are they watching it with? How do they think they're coming across? But it's incredible. And it's brilliant that it's got this second life popping up on Netflix and just sort of working its way back into the culture. I think it's something that we can all enjoy and applaud.
That's amazing. No, I'm going to be giving that a watch for sure. I'm just looking at
not
the
James, not James Winstead. I don't know where I got James Winstead from.
I'm just looking at the Entertainment Weekly review here. It describes it as one of the most revelatory rock portraits ever made. If that's not a reason to go and watch it, I don't know what is.
It's unbelievable. It's one of the best things to watch.
I just cannot wait to see it. Like it sounds, for all intents and purposes, like something I would absolutely thrive on and enjoy. But Joe, for your Might Have Missed, you've gone to Netflix as well.
Yeah, I've gone to Netflix as well. And the Fear Street trilogy, it came out at the start of July, so it kind of got a little bit lost. It's a horror trilogy released by Netflix over three consecutive Fridays. So basically, it's kind of the binge watch TV model extended onto films. And it's three stories, three kind of horror films with slightly different takes on kind of, again, some kind of classic formats. And they're set in three different years, but telling kind of one big story of this kind of curse hanging over this town. So it starts off with Fear Street 1994, which is kind of your jumping off point for the film. It's kind of the present in the kind of film universe, which then the following one goes back to the late 70s. The one before that goes back to kind of the origin of all this in kind of colonial US in 1666. But it's really well done. It's really interesting as well to see them kind of messing around with this sort of binge trilogy that they're giving you. The first one's great. It's kind of, if you're going to kind of categorize the three of them, it's kind of, the first one is kind of your slasher, there's something wrong with the town, kind of out to solve a mystery. The big kind of Stranger Thing vibes off it, but in kind of like the nostalgia. There's a bit of cast crossover even as well. It kind of feels a bit like what they were doing on their summer holidays. Which goes on to the second one is kind of basically giving you some explanation for what's happened in the first film, but going back to a story in a summer camp in the late 70s. So if the first one's kind of Scream vibes, the second one's kind of Friday the 13th vibes, then the last one in 1666 is kind of going back to the origin of the curse while still sort of bouncing back to the 94 timeline as well. And that's kind of more of a like the witch sort of throwback horror. And basically what's interesting about it is, again, it's kind of like the way films like Scream would have been very aware of horror heritage and kind of playing with convention and sort of messing around with them or kind of subverting them. It's kind of doing that as well with all these, because it is such a kind of nostalgia driven project. But it's one that just went a little bit under the radar in the heat wave. So if you're looking for something to watch and also maybe kind of gone a bit more into autumn, could be one just to earmark. But I really enjoyed them.
Excellent. No, sounds great as well. In terms of, we're tight enough on time, but in terms of the update, Sue, and what you're watching at the moment, I've gone back to, I've never seen The Wire, I'm ashamed to say. So I've just finished season one of The Wire. Like Breaking Bad was my favourite TV show of all time, and I'm hoping The Wire is up there. And so far, Omar, the character of Omar, is one of my favourite characters in any TV show ever. Just incredible. Yeah. But you've gone back to an old classic as well, Sue.
I'm still watching Sopranos, and I've got to that stage where I'm halfway through season two now, and it's consumed me completely again. So I remember the first time, I watched it when it was on TV. We're not going to talk about it all the time, but I remember like how much of a big deal it was and how much it had changed TV. And I think like retrospectively, when you look at it now, you're just like, oh my God, it literally changed everything about the way TV was made. But you forgot how spoiled you were with how good it was. And I've been watching it and totally going, why can't I watch another episode of Sopranos? I think I could fit another episode in here. And I'm waking up like in the middle of the night thinking about it and how my attitude towards different characters has changed over 20 years and how I think about them now compared to then. It's just, I shouldn't really say I forgot how good it was. I knew how good it was, but it's just been so consuming and such an enjoy. Like, I feel like I need to sit down. I'm enjoying talking Sopranos because I just need to sit down with people and talk about every single episode and James Gandolfini's performance. But the other one that I've been watching is Modern Love. It's on Amazon Prime. And I think if you're looking for something a little bit sappy and a bit, there's not really a lot of kind of romantic love, rom-com kind of things. it's nice. It's just kind of half an hour, turn your brain off kind of TV. And the Love Island finale, which I was like, thanks be to God, this is over and I can have my life back.
Yeah, thanks be to God, it's over, I think, is a sentiment most people can get behind, myself especially. Listen, guys, great stuff as always this morning, the TV picks. Sue and Joseph, thanks a million.
Thanks a million.
Cheers.
Good stuff. Sue Murphy and Joseph Connery there, as always, with the TV picks here on OTB AM. OTB AM, of course, brought to you by Gillette. Good mornings start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. It's 9:33 AM on this Thursday morning. Tomorrow morning on the show, we're hearing from Louise Galvin, ahead of Kerry Tyrone this Saturday, and her own summer with the Kerry Footballers. There's Premier League as well ahead of a very busy weekend. We'll also bring you our GAA quick picks.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.